I think maybe the dummies feel that they've had it explained to them. Thank you very much indeed for your call. Thank you for all your calls today. Back tomorrow. Global Player, please, if you missed anything, LBC app as well. It's free, it's official, you get it from everywhere. Coming up at one, Sheila Fogarty. Next, Lewis Goodall.
Thanks so much, Tom. It was once unthinkable, it is now not only thinkable, but happening. The full-blown Israeli invasion of Gaza. Palestinians are fleeing parts of Gaza City this morning after the Israeli military began the first stages of a planned ground offensive, officials in the city say. Israel's troops have established a foothold in the outskirts of Gaza City, which is home to more than 1 million Palestinians. After days of intense bombing and artillery fire, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said there needs to be an immediate ceasefire. The West has condemned, Starmer has threatened to recognise Palestine, and yet the killing continues. My question today to you is simple. When does this war end and how?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, more than 32,000 asylum seekers were being housed in hotels at the end of Labour's first year in office. The latest figures reveal a rise of 8% on a year earlier, but a slight reduction in the overall total since March. The Conservatives are urging councils to challenge the use of hotels to house migrants after an injunction was granted in Epping. The Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Philp, says they are right to raise the issue.
There are concerns which Epping Council articulated in their legal action that putting hundreds of young men into the middle of a small community can have quite significant impacts. But you know, to get to the heart of this, to really stop this problem happening, you've got to stop the crossings. And that is why Labour have made such a big mistake by allowing these crossings to reach record ever levels this year.
Labour has dismissed Kemi Badenoch's letter to local authorities as desperate and hypocritical nonsense. A woman who was jailed for inciting racial hatred in the aftermath of the Southport attack is reportedly set to be released. Lucy Connolly's 31-month prison term has been criticised by some as too harsh, but it was defended by Sir Keir Starmer earlier this year. Connolly used a social media post to call on followers to set fire to hotels housing asylum seekers. Figures show GCSE results are relatively stable compared to last year, despite an overall fall in the pass rate. Students across England, Wales and Northern Ireland have been picking up their marks this morning.
Before I got my results, I felt a bit sick. So obviously, you know, it's quite a big thing, so I was really nervous. But now I've got them, I'm so happy and I'm really glad that all my hard work's paid off.
It feels very relieving. It's like a weight off my shoulders now. I can, like, breathe now.
It was quite nerve-wracking, but I'm very happy.
Some 67.4% of all grades were at a 4 or a C and above. It is the second year grading has returned to pre-pandemic standards across all three nations. The Israeli military says its troops are now holding the outskirts of Gaza City. Officials say they've begun preliminary operations and the first stages of the ground assault on the area. The NSPCC says the law on smacking in England and Northern Ireland is out of step with public attitudes. The charity says its latest polling supports the removal of the reasonable punishment defence to justify hitting a child. Any type of corporal punishment is banned in Scotland and Wales. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 92.87. That's down one. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 15. LBC weather, a mixture of cloud and sunny spells, some isolated light showers in the north and east, a high of 21 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
It's a chill summer's day. The twins are splashing in the paddling pool while Mrs. Thing puts her feet up. She's proper chuffed, having saved money on a British Gas boiler service. Now just £69, down from £109, with a free British Gas membership. Bliss. Well, it was nice while it lasted. British Gas, taking care of things. T's and C's apply. Applies to first year of annual boiler service only and renews at standard pricing. Membership required. Available to new boiler service contract customers. Ends 9th of September. Service by 30th of September.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Oh, Well, good morning. It's 10.04. It's Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien. The great James O'Brien all this week here on LBC. Hope we find you well this morning. Grave news and grave developments, as seems so often to be the case. In Gaza this morning, unfortunately, Israel has announced it is expanding its military operations in Gaza City. This is the UK Foreign Secretary David Lammy condemning its approval of a huge new illegal settlement in the West Bank as a flagrant breach of international law, so developments in all parts of the Palestinian territories this morning. The Israeli Defence Force spokesperson, Effie Defrin, has said the IDF has begun the second phase of Operation Gideon's Chariots in Gaza, so-called, which it launched in May. He said the IDF would intensify efforts to harm Hamas in Gaza City, which he has said is a stronghold of regime and military terror as part of the operation. We, of course, talk in politics about the Overton window, don't we? This is the idea of what are the acceptable parameters of politics. What is thinkable? What is unthinkable? It is not so long ago that it would have seemed unthinkable that the IDF would be launching a full-scale invasion of Gaza with an aim to an objective to occupy the Gaza Strip. It would have once seemed unthinkable for Israeli government ministers to be talking about setting up a camp on the ruins of Rafah City in which to move a million Palestinians. That is something that has been openly posited and developed as Israeli government policy over the course of the last month or two. It would have once seemed unthinkable that we would be talking about UN agencies and international monitors talking about famine in the Gaza Strip, an entirely man-made famine. And yet here we are, day after day, the unthinkable becoming not only thinkable, but credible and realisable. Truth. This is something that I know gets a lot of emotion for understandable reasons on every single side. But what is undeniable is that those goalposts have shifted and the Israeli government is openly talking in a way which would have once seemed completely incredible only a few years ago. We've seen one of the far-right ministers in the Israeli government openly talking about authorising these illegal settlements in the West Bank for the specific reason of making the idea of a two-state solution impossible, because in his own words, there would be no Palestinian state to recognise. This, to their credit or discredit, depending on how you look at it, in fairness, is entirely open and transparent. It is not something that elements of the Israeli government are trying to hide. Meanwhile, of course, on the Gaza City situation itself, this is only threatens and can only make a dire humanitarian situation worse still. Remember that Israel had announced earlier on Wednesday, yesterday, that it was calling up an extra 60,000 reservists for the Gaza City offensive. It's justified launching a new phase by citing an attack by almost 18 Hamas fighters on an Israeli position the day before, which it had characterised as large scale, despite the fact that most impartial observers say it is a small size of reality. The humanitarian situation, as you know, remains woeful. Thousands of Palestinians facing widening conditions of starvation in Gaza had already begun to flee the city in recent days in anticipation of the assault. That is obviously going to get worse now. International condemnation coming thick and fast, as you might imagine. Jordan's foreign minister has said that Israel's assault on Gaza had caused massacres and starvation, and that its wider actions were killing all prospects for peace in the Middle East. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, has said the proposed offensive would lead to true disaster and drag the region into permanent war. Germany has said it has found it increasingly difficult to understand how these actions will lead to the freeing of the hostages or to a ceasefire. And of course, we have seen in the last few days mass protests in Israel itself, including from the hostage families, saying that the ongoing offensive in Gaza will do nothing to get the remaining hostages free, something that the Israeli government disagrees with vehemently and has said that those protests only add succour to Hamas. My question for you this morning is quite simple. This conflict has now been going on since October the 7th. I know many of you will message and say it's been going on for 75 years, I know, but I'm talking about the more confined part of this story, which obviously this new stage began on October the 7th, the heinous, horrendous attacks of October the 7th, and everything that we have seen flow from it since. That was going on now for, what, 20 months ago, going on for 2 years ago. And yet, instead of lessening, the conflict is widening. It is worsening. So my question to you this morning is, when does it end and how does it end? Because the Israeli government right now is saying it ends with Hamas's total destruction. But how on earth can we even measure that? How can we ever say that that is going to be the case? Because how can you defeat what is, in essence, not just a terrorist organisation, but an idea? 0345 6060973 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Obviously a solemn start to the show in many ways this morning, but I think you'd agree, given the gravity of the ongoing events in Gaza, it is well worth discussing. Let's turn to Yaakov Katz, author of the book While Israel Slept, former advisor to Naftali Bennett. Yaakov was also the former editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, so we're very grateful for him joining us this morning. That's my question to you, Mr. Katz, this morning. When does this end?
Well, I think it ends in a simple way, and it can end today. If Hamas were to release the Israeli hostages, 20 of whom are living, 30 who are believed to be dead, that they're still holding on to and are languishing in Hamas captivity in Gaza, release them back to Israel, say we are no longer interested in attacking Israel, we no longer want to destroy Israel, we lay down our arms, Gaza can be free, can be rebuilt, Israel can live in safety and security. It's that simple. I think no one would want to see an ending that under which Hamas remains in power in Gaza, still has weapons, still can attack, still can try to carry out another October 7th atrocity. That would not be good for Israel, would not be good for the Palestinians, and would not be good for the world.
Would the release of the hostages in and of itself, let's say that, do you really think that Mr. Netanyahu would stop the conflict then, or would he not proceed with his maximal objectives on the basis of trying to destroy Hamas if it is not already largely destroyed already?
Well, Netanyahu has already said that he wants to see a complete deal, a comprehensive deal. In other words, no longer partial ceasefires, a trickle release of just a few hostages in exchange for a cessation of the hostilities. What he is saying is, I want to see a release of all the hostages in exchange for an Israeli withdrawal from most of the Gaza Strip and the beginning of the day after, the reconstruction of Gaza. Hamas is not agreeing to that. What Hamas is now saying it might be agreeing to is a partial end to the war, which would see the release of just about 10 hostages. Israel would withdraw to some lines within Gaza, an increase in the amount of aid and construction materials allowed into Gaza. But it would not see a complete end, because as long as hostages remain, this war will not end. And I don't think that any country, not the UK, not the US, no other country in the world, would agree to a situation that a group of terrorists can cross into their country, into their territory, can take people away from their homes, their military bases, and a dance festival, and expect to get away with it. It's just not something that's acceptable anywhere in
which,
the world.
Which terrorist organization has ever been completely defeated militarily? Aren't you simply causing and creating a whole new generation with your actions, with the Israeli government's actions, in the way that it is prosecuting and conducting this war? You will have radicalized an entire new generation, which you are just handing over to Hamas.
Well, that's a terrible tragedy, what's happening in Gaza, and how the people of Gaza have been held hostage by Hamas all these years.
The Israeli government are doing it. The Israeli government
wants
killing them.
I don't think it's the Israeli government, and I'll explain. I think, for example, when we look at what Israel is trying to do, you're 100% right. You won't be able to kill every last Hamas member or collect every last AK-47 Kalashnikov assault rifle. But you can do is degrade them to the extent that they no longer have an interest in fighting. They no longer have a desire to try to destroy you. And that's just not where Hamas is right now. We saw that with ISIS. We saw that with Al-Qaeda. We saw after World War II what the British did together with the Americans against the Axis, against Japan and against Nazi Germany, took away Nazi Germany's desire to fight, took away Japan and changed its course of action and their decision to align with the West. This is what decisive victory can
The Nazis were a government that were in Germany, and we invaded Germany and we destroyed them, right? That was it. You're talking about is a terrorist organization. A terrorist organization.
No, we're not talking about a terrorist. We're talking about a terrorist organization, though, that controls a piece of territory. Hamas is the governing entity over the Gaza Strip. There was a Hamas government in
Gaza.
But
you've already...
This was orchestrated by a government with a military, with a police force. Hamas is no different. I mean, we want to try to create a difference, but sadly, there is no difference. Yes.
But you've already, I mean, let's talk about the military capacity of Hamas. This is what this entire war was said to be about, which has now gone on for 20 months. Much of its leadership, by your own government's admission, has been killed. There's Israeli officials estimate that between 15,000 to 20,000 Hamas fighters have been killed. Extensive tunnel networks have already been destroyed. Weapons factories and rocket stockpiles have already been reduced and destroyed. Rocket fire into Israel has dropped dramatically compared to late 2023. What more is left? You've already reduced Gaza to rubble. What more can you possibly do?
Give us back the hostages, but they're not, right?
But by your own admission, even if they handed over the hostages, Netanyahu wouldn't stop.
No, that's not what I said. I actually said the opposite. What I said was that if they gave over all the hostages, the war would come to an end. That is what Netanyahu has said. He wants to see a comprehensive deal under which all the hostages are released, and not a piecemeal deal, which is what Hamas wants, because it releases just a bit and then holds on and stays in power. That's not the best scenario. The best scenario is exactly what you described.
So do you
give us back all the hostages, and then the war can end and both sides can rebuild. We can create a new entity that can govern Gaza and allow the Palestinian people there to flourish into a better future. Not as long as Hamas is there. That will never be able to happen.
Where are all of the people in Gaza City supposed to go?
Well, this is a very difficult situation. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's very complicated.
It's not that complicated. You've got thousands and thousands and thousands of innocent men, women and children who have been terrorized by your rockets and your missiles and your military for going on for 2 years now. They've already lived in the most appalling conditions and endured the most appalling humanitarian situation. They are innocent. They are not at fault. And I'm just asking you, where are they supposed to go? Because it's your military which is driving them from their homes.
But no, I don't. I think we're missing a stage in the thinking here. It's Israel's military that, yes, is issuing those eviction orders and saying to them, you have to move south. But it is Hamas that is responsible for this. Again,
well, Hamas is responsible for everything the Israeli military decides to do. So you're absolved of all moral responsibility.
No, that's not at all what I'm saying. Of course, that Israel has to operate just like the UK does within the rules of war and has to abide by international legal obligations.
Well, as you know, many people think you have not.
Many people think that, but that is how wars are fought, and that's the right way that wars should be fought, and that's what Israel does, and it holds by a high, strict moral code. But the idea that we can absolve Hamas and say that this is all on Israel is also absurd. It means that we're missing the point. When you build 300 miles of tunnels under Gaza so you can protect yourselves as terrorists, you are basically hiding under civilian infrastructure, under people's homes, under hospitals, under schools. You are doing this as a way to get Israel to kill your people because you want to get at, you want these radio interviews to happen and these questions to be asked.
Absolutely.
And to put the onus and the blame on Israel as opposed to taking any responsibility as Hamas.
Would you say that highest of moral standards and responsibilities includes ensuring that everybody in Gaza has enough to eat? Because they don't at the moment, do they?
I think that Israel needs to do, personally, in my opinion, should be doing as much as possible to allow in humanitarian aid so those civilians can get food. But let's also just take a step back for one moment. I don't think anyone after 9/11, after Osama bin Laden's operatives flew those planes into the Twin Towers, and the Al-Qaeda top leadership was holed up in that Tora Bora cave complex along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. No one thought to say to George W. Bush at the time, or Tony Blair, stop bombing those caves. We got to get Al-Qaeda get them gas and food. We have to provide for them. No one ever thought that made sense.
Blair,
you don't feed the mouths that are trying to destroy you.
No, but if Blair and Bush had imposed a 20-month siege on Afghanistan and not allowed sufficient food into Afghanistan, then, yeah, there would have been a great deal of scrutiny and a number of questions about what was going on, a huge amount
exactly
of pressure.
But that's exactly what happened, and no one did that. Go back to Mosul, just more recently, in 2017, when there was almost a two-year siege.
There was not a famine in Afghanistan. There was not a famine in Afghanistan. There was not a famine in Iraq.
And Mosul, with the destruction there as well, no one had held the U.S. government and the international coalition.
There was not a famine in Iraq.
Look up the pictures now of how the destruction, the devastation
in
Mosul.
Mr. Katz, there was not a famine in Iraq or Afghanistan.
And there's not a famine in Gaza either.
Well, that, according to the world,
there are people who are starving, and I'm not going to ignore that. But let's also not forget two videos of the hostages of Yatar David and Ram Boslovsky that came out just 2 weeks ago.
I wouldn't
those
forget
that. Those are people emaciated, malnourished. Those are people who are really starving. How come they're not getting food?
I wouldn't forget that for a moment. But at the same time, it is the hostage families, as you know, which is calling on your government to stop the action in Gaza to ensure that they're released. And just on the point about famine, the World Health Organization said that before before this siege already began in Gaza City that nearly 20% of under fives in Gaza City are acutely malnourished, a rate that has quadrupled since February. So you know that there is a profound hunger problem in Gaza. There have been children who have died of malnutrition. Now that is ultimately, do you not think and do you not understand why it is the world looks at your government, the Israeli government, and holds them responsible for that?
I think the world holds Israel to a higher double standard, but I can't ignore the fact that there is a tragedy unfolding in Gaza and that Israel should be doing as much as possible to get humanitarian aid and food to feed everyone so that they can have the nourishment and the food needed to live a life that is the best possible right now under these circumstances. That I completely agree with. And if Israel is not doing enough, then more should be done. And I also have had criticism of the government for not doing when I thought it was not doing enough. I also agree that if there is an opportunity right now for Israel to end this war, to get back the hostages, and Netanyahu's government would uphold that, that would be abhorrent. Israel should, at this moment in time, if there is a deal on the table that is genuine and real, we should grab it, get our people home, and end this war so we can continue and both sides can rebuild. But as long as that does not happen, this idea that Israel should have to end the war without getting back the people who were stolen from their homes is also something that should not be acceptable. And that's what makes this war so complicated and so complex. And really, at the end of the day, I think if we really dig into who's responsible, it is Hamas that can decide, like I said, right now to end this war today.
Yaakov Katz there, author of the book While Israel Slept, former advisor to the former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, also former editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. Want to hear from you. You heard the Israeli point of view there. I want to hear from you about how you think this war ends. Would it end? I'm not convinced that Mr. Katz is right, that if the hostages were all released tomorrow, which obviously should happen, they should. What has happened to them is a tragedy of unspeakable proportions. Also those that, of course, have died. Hamas is a terrible terrorist organization, and it has no empathy even for its own people, let alone for those that it's kidnapped and killed. That goes without saying, but it should be said. Nonetheless, I'm not convinced that Netanyahu would end the war if they were released tomorrow, because I think that there are elements in his government that want to prosecute this war and use this as an opportunity to achieve their maximalist objectives of a greater Israel. And we see that playing out every single day. What do you think? 0345-6060973. 0345-6060973. Lewis Goodall here. Until 1 o'clock on LBC. The time is 10:21.
LBC.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Drop up on island fuel. Rest every 2 hours to I inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Zero, nada, zilch. When Vauxhall say 0%, they mean 0%. 0% APR is available now across the Vauxhall car range, including the all-new Frontera Electric. With a minimum 20% deposit and up to 4 years on offer, what's not to like? And now, for a limited time, get an extra £500 towards your new Vauxhall. Search Vauxhall to find out more. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, £500 contribution on new car orders between 23rd of August to 8th of September 2025. 18 plus, subject to status and availability, T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
Check you're on track for a happy retirement with PensionBee's easy-to-use app. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 10:23. Let's talk to a few of you now about what you think about all this. Jim is in Reading. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Lewis. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. Not too bad. Always good to start the show with a spirited conversation. Gets the blood running, you know?
That's for sure. Gaza. Radical solution. I know no one will ever go for this, but it's a radical solution.
Go on.
How about shipping all the Gaza people out into the West Bank and transferring all the settlers from the West Bank into Gaza? put a fence around the West Bank and let it come under international control, because the PA couldn't run a bath, never mind the country.
Yeah, I think the problem with that, Jim, I mean, first of all, I mean, it's so hard to imagine the settlers moving out, particularly under this government. But also, secondly, I mean, you'd be talking about moving 2 million people into the already very overcrowded West Bank, well, which I think would be very difficult, practically.
They did move settlers out of the Sinai, and there's quite a few of them there up where Sharm el-Sheikh is now.
Yes, that's true. That's true. You say you've been to Gaza and the West Bank yourself.
I was in the Irish Army. I lived in Beirut for most of the 1980s.
Oh, really?
I was in South Lebanon. I was in Gaza, Israel. I've been in Egypt, all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, I've reported from there myself. It is hard
One thing all the Arab countries do have in common, though, they don't want Palestinians in their country, and that's a fact.
No, that is also true, and something that we don't talk about enough, which is that there's Arab solidarity from neighbouring countries, but only so far, only up
that's
to a
correct.
Point.
That's very correct. I mean,
that's one of the tragedies.
I was in Lebanon,
yeah,
and Lebanon has been ruined by the Palestinians when the Yasser Arafat was there. I remember him very well, and at that time when I was out there, the Israeli army actually came into Lebanon, and there was like a knife through butter, and they went right in, surrounded the PLO in Beirut Harbour. And yeah. Then the French come and rescued him and brought him to Tunis.
Well, this is one of the tragedies of the sort of historical ironies and tragedies of the whole situation, is that both the Jewish people and the Palestinian people have something in common, which is that they have all been actually on the outside of their respective kind of civilizations, if you like. They've always not been wanted by, you know, the Palestinians have always, you know, historically had problems with the sort of Arab countries, and Jewish countries have Jewish people having problems with European countries and so on. There are often been underdogs within their respective parts of the world, and now they find themselves fighting each other. Jim in Reading, grateful to you. Jack is in Enfield. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning. Good morning, Lewis. I just don't think really it's going to end really until one side wipes the other side out, which is a terrible thing to say, and also I don't want it on a two-state solution, etc. As you stated yourself, you've got the settlers on one side, which are well, crazy, really extreme. And on the other side, you've got the Hamas fighters, and they're not really going to come together, are they? Do you know what I mean? So I don't know how you join that bridge, you know?
Yeah, it's really, really difficult. I mean, the problem at the moment that we've got, obviously, Jack, is that you know, you've got a government in Israel, which is mm-hmm. it's not just saying, because you could imagine a government which was more moderate, the sort of government that Israel had mm-hmm. had historically, which yeah. is to say, look, we've got a really profound security situation. We've got to do what we've got to do in terms of, like, ensuring Israel's territorial integrity, ensuring the safety of our own people. But we yeah. are at least interested in the idea of some sort of political settlement. What you've got yeah. at the moment is a government which, again, I mean, I suppose you've got to say credit to them for being straightforward. You've got a government which is literally saying, we are doing everything we can to ensure that there can never be a Palestinian state, because there will not be a sufficient territory or sufficient people to recognise. I mean, you've got Smotrich, the finance minister, saying that entirely openly in the course of the last few weeks, that is what the West Bank settlement, new settlement, is about. So I don't know what you do with that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's easy to say what you should do from the sidelines, but if it was me, yeah, I would get the settlers in order and say, what are you doing? You can't do that to people on one side. Keep them in check. And on the other side, obviously, you've got to try and, with the fighters, Hamas, etc., as the guy said, give the hostages back, etc. But I don't know, this has been going on since the end of World War One. So, you know, there's a lot of bad blood has been spilt. Do you know what I mean?
Indeed, sir. Jack, grateful to you. Grateful to all your thoughts on all that. Martin is in Tunbridge Wells. Martin, good morning.
Good morning, Lewis. I think I've calmed down now, but I was absolutely furious listening to Katz.
In which direction?
Well, I think James got it right. Boiling frogs is the analogy.
Yes.
These guys forget that the Balfour Declaration was put in place to provide a homeland for the Jewish people. It wasn't to produce greater Israel. And here's my solution. The West should grow a pair and deliver an offer to Netanyahu that we will put in troops to Gaza and West Bank to restore order and security for the Jewish people and bring some civilization back to that part of the world.
I think what's clear, Martin, I think what the thing that in the West we're not reckoning with enough, or certainly in Europe, and I think this has been happening a bit more gradually, but it's taken a while to dawn. As I was just saying, we're dealing with quite a different sort of Israeli government here. You know, we're not dealing with the sort of Israeli governments that actually characterised most of Israel's existence since the foundation of the state in 1948, dominated by either centre-left or centre-right kind of forces, Israeli Labour Party, even Likud. We're dealing, or the Likud as it was, we're dealing with, under someone like Ariel Sharon, we're dealing with Netanyahu, who he himself is radical, but his government is comprised of such hard-right, far-right forces who want to and are completely explicit about the fact that they basically want to ensure that there can never be, in any circumstances, a Palestinian state. And I think that that probably means that we, in Europe, we have to start dealing with Israel in a quite different way. It's not the traditional ally in the Middle East that we'd had before.
Totally agree. And I think that making an offer, in bracket, a threat to put Western forces, United Nations forces, that could enter Gaza by sea, could enter the West Bank from Jordan. I think the Palestinians would be content with the reassurance that that would bring and a restructuring opportunity that would lead to a two-state solution. Yeah, you're right. You're exactly right, Lewis. If all we can do is sit back and say, you know, it's these extremists in the Israeli government, and we just have to sit with it, it's shameful, quite honestly. And I think shame on the US for their lack of contribution, and double shame on the Israeli government.
Martin in Tunbridge Wells, grateful to you. I mean, yes, talking about the United States, if our question is when this war ends, there is a way that it could end reasonably rapidly, and that would be for President Trump, who has expressed great pride in the fact that he claims to have solved six wars. I don't quite know how he's got to six, but let's, for the sake of argument, live in his fantasy strip slipstream for a little bit and say he has. Well, there could be a seventh, and it would be perhaps the most important one of all, certainly up there with Ukraine, and it's in Gaza. And yet his trend towards being a blessed peacemaker does not seem to extend as far as the Gaza Strip, for whatever reason. Your thoughts on how this war will end, or whether it will ever end? 0345 6060973. Text, as always, 84850. Let's get the latest LBC News headlines, shall we, at 10:31 with Thomas Watts.
New figures show there were 32,000 asylum seekers being housed in hotels at the end of June. That's up 8% in a year. It follows a block on the use of a hotel in Epping for migrants, with other local councils looking at bringing legal challenges. Lucy Connolly, who was jailed for inciting racial hatred against asylum seekers, has been released from prison. The 42-year-old was given a 31-month jail sentence in October over a social media post in the wake of the Southport attack. The exams regulator Ofqual says the latest set of GCSE results are stable in comparison to the past 2 years. Students in England, Wales and Northern Ireland have been picking up their grades this morning. LBC weather, a mixture of cloud and sunny spells, a high of 21 degrees.
This is LBC.
Right. Any chance you could give me a hand with dinner?
Sure. Think you can manage after Dad totally smashed it last night?
Of course. I've got a HelloFresh dinner coming up, so watch out.
Wow, this is good. We're on a roll this week.
HelloFresh brings the inspiration back to dinner time. Fresh ingredients, tasty recipes, and no more staring blankly into the fridge. HelloFresh. Nothing beats dinner time. Hello.
The advert looked genuine. A post from a household name. Experts in money. A hot opportunity. They asked for a small amount. Promised a great return, took all I had, and then disappeared. Investment scammers are highly sophisticated, and every month, CEL talk to thousands of people like you who've fallen victim. Our experts can help recover your money, so head to celsolicitors.co.uk today.
CEL.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me.
You got it. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Building Society's rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/YouGov.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall. Call 0345 60 60 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
That was 10:34. We'll continue our discussion about this offensive in Gaza City shortly. First, though, more negative news for the Chancellor. We were talking about that yesterday. Britain's biggest retailers have warned Rachel Reeves that Labour's core manifesto pledge to improve living standards will be put at risk if she pushes ahead with further tax rises in her budget. This is some of Britain's biggest companies, including Tesco's, Sainsbury's, John Lewis, Boots, all warning the Chancellor that food price inflation could hit 6% this year because of the government's tax rises and policies such as the increase in the minimum wage. Quite an unusual political intervention, this, but they're writing to the Chancellor today to warn that further taxes on businesses of any sort in the autumn budget could lead to Keir Starmer breaching his manifesto pledge to provide good jobs and higher living standards, saying they will not be able to absorb further tax rises and prices will have to rise. Indeed, there was some evidence of that yesterday when we saw inflation creeping back up towards 4%, driven by higher food prices, which retailers say is partly as a result of the increase in national insurance contributions that they've been forced to pass on. Helen Dickinson is chief executive of the British Retail Consortium, joins us live on the show now. Helen, thanks so much for joining us this morning. What sort of taxes are you worried about?
Well, we saw the impact of national insurance, as you mentioned, retailers doing all they can to manage those effects, but the consequences are feeding through into inflation for families, for consumers. So the big sort of ask of the letter, the reason why retailers wanted to come together was to focus on property taxes, people taxes, things that actually impact the costs of doing business, and at the end of the day, the costs that we all pay as consumers in everything that we buy, particularly property taxes. So there are some plans for reducing property taxes for retail and hospitality businesses, which is great news. So the big ask in the letter is making sure that those reductions are significant. They really do make a difference, and that will then help retailers to be able to support growth in the economy and mitigate the risk that we're flagging, that higher costs do lead to job losses, do lead to higher inflation. So let's not go there again, because that will put the commitments that Labour has made, the manifesto commitments, at risk.
I mean, we are talking about some companies such as the supermarkets that are making quite considerable profits, aren't we, Helen Dickinson? I mean, yesterday, talking about passing it on to consumers, that ultimately is a choice. I mean, I'm looking at Tesco's profit before tax in year ending February 2024, £2.3 billion.
It's a big number. I mean, Tesco's and lots of these businesses, they employ hundreds of thousands of people. Their profit margins... Their profit margins are low, though. They make between sort of three to 4p in the pound in profits. And actually, that's a reasonable return from a shareholder point of view, and much lower than the sorts of profits that businesses were making pre-COVID and, even 5-10 years ago. And part of the reason for that is dealing with the increased costs that we've seen come through, particularly on the back of last year's budget, and the consequences of that feeding
Sainsbury's
through.
Sainsbury's last year profits forecast to be around $1 billion. I mean, these aren't companies that are doing badly, are they, Helen Dickinson?
They are companies that are competing very fiercely with each other, doing everything they can to mitigate the cost increases that they are seeing and trying not to pass on, given the competitive nature of the market, any into their customers. But we are seeing that feed through into inflation, and that is something that we don't want to continue to see as we move into Christmas and into 2026. There are 100,000 fewer people who work in retail today than there were 12 months ago. So there are consequences for for communities, for families.
But I suppose my question, Helen, is, and I can see some people asking this, given that we are talking about, yeah, it's a highly competitive market, I get that, and they employ lots and lots of people, and they're good employers, et cetera, wouldn't dispute that, but they are making big profits. So why don't they just absorb some of that extra cost? Why do they have to pass it on to consumers if it's as competitive a market as you say?
Well, they have absorbed some of it, which is the reason why the profit margins are lower than they have been historically. So, you know, companies do need to make a profit. 3p in the pound isn't, you know, these are low margins compared to other industries. Retailing is a tough business. They compete fiercely with each other. And really, the rationale behind the letter was really just to make the sort of strength of views across the industry known to government and just point out what some of the consequences would be if we see further increases in taxes, particularly in those property taxes on retail businesses, and what that means for the commitments made in the manifesto and what that means for us all as consumers.
What's your sense of how the British economy is doing? Obviously, we've got some quite negative indicators and statistics come back over the last couple of months. What's your sense of the outlook for the remainder of 2025 going into 2026?
I mean, I'm nervous about the outlook. We've seen, certainly from a retail point of view, a number of businesses fall by the wayside over the course of the last couple of years. And even, you know, a company like Claire's Accessories going into administration earlier this month. We've seen job losses across the industry. So I think, you know, there are things that are within the control of the government, the policy decisions that they make in the future. And what retail has is a scale and reach right across sort of every community in the country. And I think what we want to do is give that industry its best chance to support the growth that the government and that we all want to see as we look forward. So it's not a foregone conclusion. There are risks there, and this is all about how we can mitigate some of those risks.
Helen Dickinson there, Chief Executive Officer of the British Retail Consortium, as I say, some of the biggest retailers in the country, writing to the Chancellor this morning, urging her not to increase taxes on business again, saying that it will damage the competitiveness of the British economy. Let's return to that conversation about Gaza. Samantha is in Elstree. Samantha, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a couple points if I can. The first point kind of leads to the second, which is that I've always believed in a two-state solution. I'm Jewish, and I have family in Israel, and I've always believed that until October the 7th. And what that showed is how quickly Hamas were able to murder 1,200 people. And should they have been able to do that from the West Bank, geographically speaking, the damage would have been 10 times worse. And we should believe them when they say we want to do October 7th over and over again. And this leads me to my second point, which is how do we stop this? And I genuinely believe that seeing as 2.1 million Arabs live peacefully in Israel, it's about re-education. Because what we're seeing coming out of Gaza is honestly devastating to see for me. And when we see things like children's TV shows with the characters shouting, kill the Jews, stone the Jews, or children's educational worksheets that have been, you know, shown to us that talk about, you know, if you kill one Jew, how many have you got left, kind of that situation. What do you expect children to believe growing up? And it's so devastating to me to see that people hate Jews that much that they would rather put their lives, their kids' lives at risk than just trying to get on with Jewish people. It's mind-blowing to me. And it is starting to happen. We're seeing things come out now of people actually trying to re-educate and show that Jewish people aren't the devil and we're not these evil people and that we can live together. And I think that's the only way we're going to have a two-state solution is when we feel like they don't want to harm us. They don't want to kill Jewish people.
I think this is one of the problems, isn't it, Samantha? And we see this in periods of sort of ongoing conflict and war. The dehumanisation on both sides of the other is profound, and we're seeing that. You know, that something we see it in Israeli society as well. I'm sure it happens the other way, but you know, something it's this is happening over there, and people avert their gaze, and I can understand it, and I can understand how this happens, but it is how you end up getting to a situation where people can become indifferent to the suffering of others.
Yeah, the dehumanization is honestly quite, it's devastating, like you said, on both sides to see, but what we can see works is that if you go into Jerusalem, for example, you see Muslims, Jews living together side by side, and it's it's amazing and it's wonderful. And there are no Jews living in Gaza. We're not allowed in Gaza. And we've seen what happens to the people, the Jewish people that are currently being held in Gaza in inhumane conditions. I don't know how we get around that. I don't know how we turn that around without Hamas being removed from the situation. And they're not going away anytime soon.
Yeah. Samantha in Austria making a very important point, and the dehumanisation element is one of the things which is most disturbing about this entire conflict. Naz is in Enfield. Naz, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to say I find that our governments are very hypocritical, and no one's doing enough. For Ukraine, all the leaders went over to the US. Netanyahu was given the red carpet in the US.
Well, he always is, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah. Putin is called a war criminal, and Netanyahu, he can go, you know, people don't...
Well, to be fair, Putin was given the red carpet as well, so...
Yeah. No, to be fair. But your last caller was saying all this, and I was thinking about Hamas... In the ceasefire, they said they were going to agree to a ceasefire a few times, and Israel has broken it. But in the Western media, it's reported that Hamas have broken it all the time. Now, I'm not defending Hamas at all. I'm just saying that we have to be fair. And your last caller, dehumanization. The settlers are the things they call the other side, and what they do to them. You know. Palestinians are called human animals as well, and they keep on saying, you know, for me, like with even with my Jewish friends, we you know, you have to respect life on both sides, and until they respect life, and until the West does something like peacekeeping troops instead of just saying, oh, this is wrong, oh, we, you know, if it was somewhere else, we'd be there. But there's no, you know, it's heartbreaking for me. I know so many people who have been affected. And look how many people are dying. And your last caller was saying about dehumanizing of Jews. And that's true. We don't want anybody to be dehumanized. But Jews are indoctrinated as well. I'm not Jews, sorry. Israelis are the Zionist type people who hate. They hate as well. If you just look at the posts on social media.
Not everybody, we should say, of course. It is not. It's that, yeah.
No. On both sides.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of hate on the other side as well. Please stop saying that, you know, that Hamas is not the Palestinians. The Palestinians are dying. They're starving.
Yeah, many Palestinians loathe Hamas and abhor them.
Yeah, and so they're being punished, you know, blanket bombing, and now it's more and more. What's the West going to do? Are they going to just stand by and just say, oh, you know, slap Netanyahu on the wrist, or are they going to have some, you know, gumption? Look, in World War II, we said never again, but we didn't mean never again just for one or two communities. It has to be for everyone.
All right, Naz in Enfield, grateful to you. A bit of breaking news as well with regards to Lucy Connolly. You may have seen this and followed this story. This is a Northampton childminder who was jailed for inciting racial hatred after the Southport murders. She has been released from prison. The wife of Conservative councillor Raymond Connolly handled a 31-month sentence in October last year after she admitted to publishing and distributing threatening or abusive material on the X site, becoming a bit of a cause célèbre on the online right. Well, Lucy Connolly has now been released. More of your calls to come very shortly. For now, you're listening to me, Lewis Goodall, in for James O'Brien all this week on LBC. The time is 10:47.
LBC.
Have you ever wondered what a sandwich sounds like? Not much to it, is there? Unless, of course, it's a Walker's sandwich. Mmm, that is good. Now that's what a sarnie should sound like. Go all crisp in with Walkers. Delicious.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Who's a good human?
Jenny is, because Jenny will always do what's best for Bertie, her bestie Bassett. So if Bertie needs to go and wee, that's what they're going to do. Even if it is 3 a.m. and it's raining cat lots. That's why she also chooses Butternut Box for Bertie's meals. Freshly prepared, served straight from the fridge, and conveniently delivered right to your door. At a time that suits you for once. Hey, Jenny.
Oh.
Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
Ugh. Drizzly drive to the office. Ever wanted to just shove some bits in a bag? Hop on a plane. And land somewhere magnifique? Well, with Kayak Explore, it's easier than ever. Whatever your budget, wherever you want to go, simply set the amount you want to spend and Kayak finds flights that fit. Easy breezy. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
When they're away at uni and the show you all love is on telly. When you're miles apart but still laughing at the same joke. When the emojis come thick and fast.
Ah, triple smiley face and a heart.
I knew they'd love that.
Nothing brings us together like great TV. Make sure your child has a TV license when they go to uni, so they're covered to watch all TV channels and you can still enjoy all those TV moments in the family group chat.
There's plenty of summer still left to enjoy and lots of wines to enjoy it with. At Waitrose, we've got 25% off six or more bottles of wine or fizz over £6, like the citrusy Esprit de Chablis, perfect with chicken on the barbecue, or a Minuti M Special Edition Rosé, bursting with strawberries, grapefruit and delicate peach, and a fruity San Leo Prosecco, best paired with a sunny spot in the garden. Fill the last days of summer and your wine rack with 25% off at Waitrose. Selected stores and lines, subject to availability, exclude Scotland, boxed wines and bottles priced £100 and over.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 10.50. We will return to our conversation about Gaza in a moment. But obviously today we're getting towards the end of August, towards the end of summer, alas. And of course that can only mean one thing, and that is GCSE results day. GCSE pass rate falling again for the fourth year in a row, with 67.4% of all grades in England, Wales and Northern Ireland at 4 or C and above. It makes me feel so old, this number thing now. And I feel like I used to, when people used to talk about like O-levels and CSEs and all that sort of stuff. Hundreds of thousands of students, of course, opening their GCSE BTEC Cambridge National results. Let's turn now to Neil Trivedi, also known as Neil Does Maths, TikTok's top maths teacher. And again, this is making me feel old, Neil, because I didn't know you could learn maths off TikTok.
Hey, Lewis, thanks for having me on your show. And thanks for calling me the best maths teacher on TikTok. That's very generous of
you. Well, I'll be honest with you. It was just what was written in front of me, Neil, given that I have just confessed that I didn't even know you could learn off TikTok until about 30 seconds ago. So there you are. But I'm sure you are. I'm sure you are. Elliot wrote it down. The producer, Elliot, wrote it down. And he wouldn't be wrong, I can tell you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So what are we learning about these results today? Anything that's surprising you?
I mean, it was interesting with all these headline percentages saying things are going down, things are getting worse, things are always quite dark on these days. They try and paint things to be worse than they really are. I would probably say, you know, even though things may have looked like they've decreased, I would say unless we have a year-on-year comparison that's actually effective, meaning keeping the variables the same, you know, students are not sitting the same exam year on year, the grade boundaries are not the same year on year.
A lot of the goalposts are moving.
So many things are changing. I personally don't think looking at these numbers are effective for children, teachers, parents. I think it's more important to focus on the children themselves. What are the next steps? These are going to be the first time. Well, this is going to be the first time they open a set of results that really define their future pathways, because you know, the last time this happened was in Key Stage 2, Year 6, and their pathway, no matter what results they get, is still fixed. They have to go to high school. So here things really change direction.
I noticed something in some of the reporting about it, which is specific to you, Neil, and maths, which is that the latest results suggest that the government's policy of forcing struggling students to resit maths and English GCSEs, Guardian reporting, is turning into something of a crisis, with increasingly poor performance by students taking the exams for second or third times. And for those aged 17 or older in England, the bulk of whom are retaking the subjects having failed to get grade 4 or better first time round, just 17% got a grade 4 above in maths. Nearly a quarter of GCSE maths entries now are resits at an all-time high. So it doesn't seem like this policy, well, making them resit, it doesn't seem to be working very effectively.
No, it doesn't. And I think, again, this comes back to the whole system of, you know, grade boundaries are set by senior examiners, a small portion of people, you know, year-on-year exams not being the same. Obviously, you don't want them to be the same, but I feel like the whole exam system has become a game of, you know, you sit these exams and we decide if you pass or not, because we're going to set these grade boundaries based on some data, and we believe this paper was a bit easier, so we're going to increase the grade boundaries significantly. So what's happening in schools is they recognize that this is becoming a, you know, we need students to be able to answer in maths the first 8 questions to be able to get that grade 4 and above. So we're just going to teach them the topics that we believe are grade 4 topics, which I don't believe is the correct way to do things. And, you know, I feel it's really unfair on the children, because then they're stuck in this endless loop of, I can't progress further until I pass my English and maths. And all I need to be able to do is answer these 8 questions. Yeah. And that's it.
So forgive my ignorance, Neil, because obviously it's a while since I did my exams now. And certainly TikTok wasn't around then. So is it a really common thing to learn maths off TikTok?
Yeah, it's actually post-COVID has become a really interesting time. Some very cool statistics actually shows that the gap between students' results in London, which has statistically been higher than outside of London, that gap is closing. And the gap between girls and boys is also closing, which could show that children having this more freedom of information online, so through TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, also what we do here at MyEdSpace with these online lessons, is that the freedom of information is a lot greater. So more children are moving on to online spaces, which is where they're all hanging around, and they're, one, being entertained by the online space, but also learning. So what I do and what the other teachers here do is we try and move into this infotainment space, where we try and make learning engaging and informative, and bring education to where children are hanging out most. So, okay. Many children are now learning from TikTok.
Fascinating. Neil Trivedi there, also known as, I say, as Neil does maths, TikTok's top maths teacher. I just actually realised working out here that it was 20 years ago in 2005 that I was picking up my GCSEs, which makes me feel really, really old. I did pretty well, but by the way, in case you were wondering. Louise in Billericay, let's turn to you about Gaza. Louise.
Hi, Lewis. How are you?
I'm not bad, thank you. Not bad at all. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I was just saying to your producer that I have a pretty unique perspective on this. Back in 1989, I lived in Israel, and I actually was working for Magen David Adom, who are the Israeli ambulance service. Right. And that was the time, Lewis, of the last intifada, the second intifada. So I was actually going to a lot of horrific terrorist attacks. So, you know, I'm listening to this unfold, and I feel like I'm screaming into a vacuum, Lewis, because nobody can accuse me of being anti-Semitic. I love Israel. I went and lived there. I volunteered for them. I endured horrific experiences, and I wouldn't change any of it. But let's stop talking about Israel, and let's start talking about the right-wing Netanyahu government. Mm-hmm. Those are the people, Lewis. We have to stand up to him. We have to take greater action than we have, and we have to do it for all those people suffering in Gaza, for all the people that have suffered in Israel, because he is not Israel. That is not the Israel I know. He does not represent the Israeli people I know and love.
No, and he's we should always make that clear. And if anyone wants any proof of that, then they should just turn their attention to the enormous protests, the general strikes that we've seen. The numbers of people taking to the streets of Israel to protest against the Netanyahu government in the last, you know, 18 months or so.
Yeah, but what I saw, and what my point to your producer was, Lewis, is when your question is, how is this war going to end? My answer to you is, it's not. There's a conflict, there's a war zone, but the actual fight is not going to end when a ceasefire comes. I was the person that was picking up the body parts, literally. You cannot, and even if you turn Israel into a police state, and this will overflow from Israel to everybody perceived as an ally, I can tell you some of the worst terrorist attacks I went to were one individual, not something that you can plan. And I really want to hear people talking. I understand the focus is on the immense suffering we're seeing in front of us. But this is not a one-phase situation, Lewis. There's going to be blowback, and it's going to be global.
All right. Louise, grateful to you. Louise in Billericay there. Let's just give the last word to John, who I know has been waiting on a line in Bristol. John, good morning. Last word to you on this.
Morning, Lewis.
Your
How
thoughts?
Are you doing? You okay?
I'm fine, thank you. Not bad at all, apart from that crushing realisation of picking my GCSEs up 20 years ago today. But apart from that, I'm fine.
Yeah, we've all been there. just want to make a quick point with regards to Israel-Gaza. Back in 2005, when they had their supposed first open elections, 46% of the people voted for a terrorist organisation and 42% voted for a former terrorist organisation, Fatah. And apparently the turnout was particularly large. Now, you can argue it wasn't a free and fair election, but we are where we are. And I suspect if there were to be a two-state solution at any point in the future, all that's going to happen within about a decade, there'll be an extreme government voted back into Palestine, and you will then have a government attacking Israel.
John, given that roughly half the population of Gaza, who are currently there now, weren't alive when those elections took place, then can we really hold them responsible for that?
No, not at all. But, you know, there has to be a solution. And just going around in circles as we are, you know, there's been four offers of a two-state solution to the Palestinians over the last 30, 40 years. None of it's acceptable. I think if our politicians and the public were a bit more honest with each other, this is a religious war. This is Islam against Judaism. It's as simple as that. Given the opportunity, every single Jew in Israel would be killed by the Palestinians. They've been at war with all the Islamic countries around them for decades.
Well,
just to drive them out of the region. It's as simple as that.
All right, John, we have time to go into that, but I think that given that a lot of Palestinians live in Israel and are Israeli citizens, that's a rather peculiar take, to put it mildly, but we're going to leave it there. The Chancellor, as we know, we've been discussing over the past few days, is in a desperate hunt to try and find new sources of revenue in anticipation of the autumn budget, given that she's ruled out raising VAT or employer national insurance or tax rises on income. So the suggestion is she might try and look at inheritance tax, something that has been warned against by research and wealth manager Today. My point to you, and I know this might get some of your backs up, is I don't think the Chancellor's going far enough. How about a 100% inheritance tax?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, the number of asylum seekers being housed in hotels increased by 8% in the year to June. Figures show the total rose to 32,000, but was still far below the peak of 56,000 recorded in September 2023. It follows a council's successful challenge over the use of a hotel in Epping in Essex. LBC's political editor Natasha Clark says it's not just Conservative and Reform authorities looking at following suit.
There are, of course, a number of Labour ones that are frustrated with national government and with the sheer numbers of people that they are being told to take. And we know the Home Office at the moment scrambling to find alternative accommodations for those who are in the Bell Hotel in Epping. And at the moment, the Home Office saying they are braced for more potential legal challenges just like this.
Lucy Connolly, who was jailed for inciting racial hatred against asylum seekers, has been released from prison. The 42-year-old was given a 31-month sentence in October last year over a social media post on the day of the Southport murders. She posted posted on social media calls for mass deportation and to set fire to migrant hotels. The Education Minister, Catherine McKinnell, was asked if Connolly's sentence was too harsh.
My understanding is that in this case, the CPS were satisfied that the incitement provisions in the Public Order Act were relevant and should be used. That was the decision that was taken. As I said, though, it is a matter for the independent courts, and we absolutely support the courts and their independence and the police and their very difficult job of keeping us safe.
A would-be assassin whose plot failed when her gun jammed has been jailed for 30 years. Amy Betrow, who is 45, disguised herself in a niqab when she tried to kill her partner's rival in Birmingham in 2019. The US national was convicted of conspiracy to murder earlier this month. The exams regulator Ofqual says the latest set of GCSE results is stable in comparison to the past 2 years. Students in England, Wales and Northern Ireland have been picking up their marks this morning. Some 67 77.4% of grades were at 4 or above, representing a slight fall in the overall pass rate. Government borrowing slowed to a lower than expected £1.1 billion in July. That is the lowest such figure for 3 years, thanks to an increase in national insurance and other tax receipts. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was at 92.87. That's down a point. The pound buys $1.34 and a €1.15. LBC weather, most places seeing a mixture of cloud and sunny spells, some isolated light showers in the north and east, a high of 21 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11.04. Now, time to be a little bit controversial with some of you. But I'm not just being controversial for the sake of it. It's something that I've long believed. The truth is sometimes people say you're left-wing or you're right-wing or whatever. Truth is most people are a sort of agglomeration of different views from different parts of the spectrum. I think it's fair to say this might be my most left-wing political view, but let me explain why. And let me give you some background to it before we start the conversation, because I know many of you will disagree. And that's fine. That's what this is all about. There have been suggestions in the last couple of days the Chancellor is thinking about tightening up rules on inheritance tax, a tax which currently raises only applies to about 6%, 7% of all estates and raises about 10, 11 billion pounds a year. She's thinking about tightening up the rules to make it so that there's currently a bit of a loophole where if you gift someone something, then you do it within, and you don't die within 7 years, then basically it's no longer subject to inheritance tax, more or less. Chancellor apparently thinking about tightening up this rule. Now, there's a wealth manager, weird they'd think, this isn't it, a wealth manager, manager, Quilter and the Centre for Economics and Business Research, a consultancy, has warned this morning that going after family gifts in an inheritance tax grab, as the Times puts it, why is it always a tax grab, I wonder, tax grab, risks cutting struggling young families off from vital support. The typical pensioner gives 10% of their income, an average of almost £2,500 away to family each year, they say. And they say that if you were to change the rules, that basically young families would struggle. Rachel Griffin from Quilter says, there's a strong economic case for supporting the transfer of wealth between generations. Weird that a wealth manager would think that, isn't there? Oh, because the thing is, if you transfer wealth, who do you need? Oh, right, yeah, a wealth manager. Okay. Younger people face significant financial pressures, she says, from high housing costs to childcare and limited pension savings. So while older generations often hold substantial assets, sensible rules help to unlock this capital at the right time. Now, leaving aside the fact that there may be a little bit of touch of self-interest from Ms. Quilter, from Ms. Griffin, from Quilter there, it's an interesting argument. She's basically saying that because generational inequalities are so severe, something that I talk about a lot and I have complete agreement with and concern about, the best way of addressing those inequalities is by making sure that some people from wealthy families and younger people can benefit from the inheritance of their forebears. Now, of course, this does pose the obvious question, or two obvious questions to me, at least. One is, okay, but what is the kind of moral right to inherit? And second, well, what about everybody else, those who are not so lucky to have wealthy forebears? Let me just explain and give you some context in all of this. I'm a great believer that we need to have fewer taxes on earned work, on income. I think it's absolutely right. When the right say that we're overtaxed, they're correct. The numbers of people who are now being dragged, young people in particular, who are now paying higher rate income tax is far higher than it was ever supposed to be or it ever was in the past. That is a situation which seems only set to worsen in the coming budget, with a chance that I think very likely not to changed tax thresholds as would have been done in the past according with inflation. That was a cheeky little trick, nasty little trick that the previous Conservative government did again and again and again. So although you're not changing the top rate of income tax, in reality, what you're doing with inflation is dragging more and more people into it. You have got younger people who are starting their careers now, sometimes paying marginal tax rates when you throw in their student loan, which has basically become impossible to pay off under repeated changes to the rules. You know, marginal tax rates of 30, 40, 50%, right? Meanwhile, you've got wealth, which is relatively untaxed in this country, and it is hard to tax. I appreciate that. It can be harder by comparison to income. But you've got older generations which are sitting on big, big assets and unearned income from those assets, which are being taxed at a far lesser rate. So we saw, for example, when Rishi Sunak published his tax return, that his overall rate of tax, given so much of his income was being generated by wealth, by unearned income, we saw him paying a marginal tax rate, which was far lower, in the 20 or 30%, far lower than people who have no assets, working every hour God sends, day after day after day, just to put food on the table, who are on much lower incomes. This is a big problem. It's something we saw a picture of, which was much more like the 19th century than the early to mid 20th century, when there was a huge, huge, a sort of gilded age, the huge, huge inequalities, particularly in wealth, where you had huge parts of the sort of upper echelons of society basically living off their wealth and their inner unearned income, while people lower down the chain had no wealth whatsoever. Let me give you some statistics on this. The bottom 50% of the population in this country own less than 5% of the country's total wealth, while the top 10% hold over 57%. That's up from 52% in 1995. The top 1% alone in the UK owns nearly a quarter, 23% of Britain's wealth. That is a massive difference and way more unequal compared to income, right? The wealth gap between the top and bottom 20% in this country rose roughly £7.5 trillion from 2011 to 2019. From £7.5 trillion to £11 trillion, largely driven by property values. There's huge regional disparities as well, right? So we're dealing with a context where there is truly enormous inequalities of wealth. And that has a big effect. It has a big effect if we hope in any way to achieve a truly meritocratic society. Why? Well, because if you have dynastic wealth, it entrenches inequality. Without high inheritance taxes, families just accumulate wealth and more wealth and more wealth, generation after generation after generation, regardless of their merit, regardless of their productivity, regardless of whether they're doing anything to earn it. They're just lounging around in their yachts off the Mediterranean coast, and they're just getting richer and richer and richer because the entire system is geared towards they're getting richer. Meanwhile, you've got the wage slaves out there, to put it provocatively, no wealth, having to pay higher marginal tax rates time after time after time on their income because they have no assets and they have no wealth. If you tax large inheritances properly, my contention to you is that it prevents an aristocracy of wealth from forming and it keeps opportunities open in society. What we've got at the moment is an aristocracy of wealth in this country. It's also true of the United States as well. So what I would do, and I wouldn't be opposed to, by the way, I wouldn't be opposed to 100% inheritance tax. Or maybe let's say 99%. You know, my rule might be that if you can put it in 2p bags, then you can hand it over. That's fine. 99, 95%. I'm being provocative, but you see what I mean. I would not be against a far higher rate of inheritance tax than we have at the moment, which is 40% above a certain threshold. I wouldn't be opposed to putting that to 50%, 60%, 70%. Why? Because I think the quid pro quo should be twofold. One, that helps fund public services, which actually helps level the playing field in achieving a true meritocracy. Two, it will help us reduce taxes on income. Because at the end of the day, I want to incentivize work. I want to incentivize productivity. I want to incentivize people to get up off their backsides and do more That doesn't work when you have such a disparity between taxation on wealth and taxation on income. My contention is, and I know this is controversial, I know not everybody agrees with it, but my contention is this: you don't have a right to inherit. You should have a right to be to work while you're alive and get keep more of your own money. That, to me, is more important, way more important, than your right to just inherit some money from mummy and daddy that you did nothing to earn. We need to move away from the rentier economy that we have moved to and move to a society where work is rewarded, where, yeah, you can keep more of your own money in your own pocket at the end of the month because you're working harder, rather than being faced with extra taxation after extra taxation after extra taxation. And just hope, as this silly little wealth manager seems to think, that the best hope, your best hope, will be just to hope that maybe at some point you might inherit some money from your nan and granddad or your mum and dad. What kind of society is that? And the thing is, if you go back, we've had those sort of inheritance tax rates before, by the way. This wouldn't be new. Actually, if you go back, the first estate duties that we saw were imposed in the early 20th century by the Liberal government at that time because they needed to fund the First World War. And you saw big estate duties. And actually, you had a lot of estates broken up at that time because you had, unfortunately, fathers and sons dying in the First World War from aristocratic estates. It was so controversial. Lloyd George famously said that he would tax the rich till the pips squeak. Likewise, after the Second World War, we had higher rates of inheritance tax. Guess what? Society was fairer. There was more of a meritocracy than there is today. There was less dynastic inheritance of wealth. So we're not talking about doing something new here. We're actually talking about doing something old. And I think that there is a very solid case, a progressive case, a case that everybody should be in favour of. Not just a progressive case, but I think that if you're on the right as well, you should be in favour of people working harder while they're alive, not just inheriting something when your mum and dad are dead. I don't understand it. I understand that there are people that, you know, people will say, look, I want to pass on something to my kids. I understand that. I understand that. I mean, I still would be in favour of 100% inheritance tax, actually, because I actually think my kids, if I had them, I'd be like, well, go and earn your own crust. But, you know, I can understand why you want to inherit something. But I don't see why you have a right to inherit. I don't think there is a right. I think you have a right to be expect to receive income, as much income as possible, from your own work, not from the work of somebody else. I think at the moment, this aristocracy of wealth that we are developing is making the whole country poorer, or at least the whole country poorer, but them. So if the Chancellor wants to really, really be radical in this budget, then doing something like this, I think, would not only raise tens and tens of billions of pounds, but it would level the playing field for future generations. This is something, by the way, that previous, you know, you go back hundreds of years, Enlightenment thinkers were thinking about all the time. Thomas Jefferson said that the land belongs to the living, not to the dead. He actually thought there should basically be a rearrangement of land every 17 years as a result of a sentence to make sure that we are not being governed by the decisions of our fathers and mothers before us. Because why on earth should someone who just happened to be... We've got people in this country today who are the great, 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 great sons and daughters of grandsons and daughters of people who happen to do well in the Victorian period, and they're still living off the fat of their land. Why? What have they done to deserve it? Nothing. We just expected to deal with it as if it's normal. It's only normal because that's the world that we've grown up in. And I think, and you've got societies in the world that do have far higher rates of inheritance tax, like Japan, for example, a dynamic economy. It works. We just think that there's a weird, weird ability and a right to inherit. So why don't we actually start, and there's a generational element to this too, why don't we start moving the burden of taxation to wealth? People always say, oh, how do you tax wealth? This is how you do it. This is how you do it. Your calls to come on this. I suspect that you might disagree. Or maybe you agree. I don't know. Maybe I've convinced you. That would be nice. Doubt it. 0345-6060-973. 0345-6060-973. Your thoughts on a 100% inheritance tax. Or 90 or 80. Just higher than where it is at the moment. Your calls, as I say, to come on that. You're listening to me, Lewis Goodall, here on LBC. The time is 11:17.
LBC.
There's plenty of summer still left to enjoy and lots of wines to enjoy it with. At Waitrose, we've got 25% off six or more bottles of wine or fizz over £6, like the citrusy Esprit de Chablis, perfect with chicken on the barbecue, or a Minuti M Special Edition Rosé, bursting with strawberries, grapefruit and delicate peach, and a fruity Sanleo Prosecco, best paired with a sunny spot in the garden. Fill the last days of summer and your wine rack with 25% off at Waitrose. Selected stores online, subject to availability, exclude Scotland, boxed wines and bottles priced £100
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future, with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line, already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
The new single drop. The world tour begins. As artists create the music we love, you could be right there in the mix. Calling all young creatives. If you want a career in music, then listen up. Global Academy have a new 6-4 music production course. State-of-the-art studios, practical experience, hands-on learning with music professionals. Awesome! Apply now at globalacademy.com.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time is just approaching. We're just about to turn 11:19. I can see a few of you have already texted in about this. Yes, yes, lots of you. Peter says, Lewis sounds like he will make his kids pay for their own birthday presents. Now, there's an idea, Peter. Beatrice says, I think the poorest pay too much tax, but those over 100,000 pay too little tax. When it gets to multimillionaires and billionaires, they pay proportionally nothing. Burgers, in terms of tax, we need to see taxpayers as heroes. We should give an award to those who pay the most tax. Will says, why is having assets classed as unearned income? The ownership of any asset is a gamble because the investment can go up or down. Well, Will, it's not so much the asset, it's the income which derives from it. And another text here says, hi, Lewis, inheritance tax needs to change. Duke of Westminster in 2016 paid zero inheritance tax on 10 billion. Well, indeed. And that's why the beauty of my system is it would be universal. There would be no getting around it. Jackie in Guildford has something to say about this. Jackie, good morning.
Hi, Lewis. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. I've just put my tin hat on.
I can see how passionately you feel about the subject, and I've got a variety of views on it. And one is that I've been lucky enough to receive gifts of cash within the tax thresholds from my parents,
yeah,
who are really comfortably off. Over the last, probably they've been doing it for about 5 or 10 years now, where they've just gifted their maximum to myself and my sister, just to help us out, because, you know, it does help us out. It helps us pay for the big things like the car insurances and the home insurances and stuff like that. And so it's really helped us to stay afloat in a time when it's, you know, tricky to make ends meet a lot of the time. But at the same time, I do think I am very much in the camp of the taxable, the way that people are taxed in the country is not working, is it? So there's a lot to do, I think, in the respect of putting a bigger burden on people who have got a lot more money, a lot more wealth.
I think what we could say, Jackie, is that the Chancellor, I think, is right. And look, I mean, you know, I'm being a bit provocative, but you could, you know, there's an argument to be had about where the threshold is and everything like that. At the moment, obviously, we've got a kind of system which I think what the Chancellor is driving at is that it is open to people trying to get around it with the 7-year gift element, right? And that's and it probably does need some tightening up, because at the moment, arguably, we're in probably the worst of all worlds, where rich people can afford to pay, you know, accountants and so on, and wealth managers, like from whom we heard earlier, to kind of get around some of the rules, and then people who are maybe a bit more middling off end up getting hit by it.
Yeah, and that will always happen, because the accountants are able to use the law to find things that a bit mechanisms like trusts and other financial vehicles to put that money into something that isn't treated for tax in the same way that estate tax will work for a family when somebody dies. So yeah, it's not easy to sort out, but it always it always really makes me very confused. There are some really smart people who are really good at maths, and I can't understand why they haven't figured this conundrum out with all the taxes and inheritance taxes in the country. I think there's got to be answers here, and somebody has got them. It's just that they're not brave enough to implement them, I think, maybe.
Jackie, grateful to you. Thanks very much for kicking us off with that little bit of breaking news as well this morning. Lots of it actually around this morning. Italian police have arrested a Ukrainian man suspected of coordinating the attacks on the Nord Stream pipelines in 2022. You'll be aware Nord Stream pipelines in the Baltic Sea have been a source of, well, some difficulty, geopolitical difficulty, ever since the start of the Ukraine war. Lots of attacks from rather suspicious sources. Lots of accusations about the Russians being involved in one way or another. Well, anyway, the Italian police arresting a Ukrainian man suspecting of coordinating those 2022 early attacks. We'll keep an eye on that and bring you any updates as we receive them. Tony is in Worcester Park, who also has something to say about inheritance tax. I think disagrees with me on this. Tony, good morning.
I do disagree with you, actually. I do apologise to disagree with you, but...
That's all right, that's fine. Yeah, that's all right. That's what it's all about. It'd be very boring if everyone agreed.
Yeah, yeah, but the problem is, you see, personally, I've worked hard.
Yeah.
I've really worked hard, you know, I don't sound like a martyr, but physically, and we're lucky, God has allowed us to be in a position where we have our mortgage paid, and we have... funds living off the interest. And the point is, why should I have to, why should I have to give it away to somebody else?
Well, the argument would be, Tony, that if you are going to have a society which is based on merit and not on entrenched wealth, because you can see the problem that wealth creates wealth, which creates wealth, right, over the generations.
I'm with you.
And that therefore there has to be, and I, you know, as I say, I'm being provocative with the 100% thing, but yeah. At the moment, the argument would be that wealth is taxed too lightly by comparison to income, and it would be better for example, your kids, to pay less tax when they're alive rather than just waiting for, well, you know, with respect, you to shuffle off this mortal coil and hand it over to them.
Well, no, yeah, I agree with you, because I said years ago, the wealth we're accruing in properties is going to come and get grabbed by the government at some time.
Yeah.
That's a fact. It's going to happen. It has to happen. Yeah. But what mechanism you use, is it at your death, or, as I feel they're going to do, is what they're going to do, they're going to start making you pay for it in real time.
Yes.
Well, that's what I feel.
Yes. What do you think?
I disagree with it.
Do you think, I mean, currently the rate is at, the rate is if you're a married couple, you can basically pass on, depending on how you work it out, between 750,000 and 1,000,000 tax-free. And then everything over that is 40%.
Where'd you get that from?
Well, that's HMRC. That's the policy on inheritance tax at the moment. Now, those are the thresholds at the moment. If you're a married couple, because you basically put your allowance together and you get about 750,000 with it, and you can pass that on tax-free. Yeah. And everything else is taxed at 40p in the pound on the estate. Do you think that that's too low, too high? About right?
As a socialist, thinking it's in a socialist manner, I'm a convenient socialist, I think it's too low.
You think it's too low? Yeah.
Yeah, but being selfish, I think I should have a choice to do what I want with my money.
Yeah.
That's a conundrum.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to alienate people.
All right. Okay. Grateful, Tony, for you on that. Let's turn to Liz, who is a first-time caller from Bury St Edmunds. Liz.
Hi, Lewis.
Good morning.
Good morning. Apologies. I've just literally tuned in after GCSE results day. And
how did they do?
I could not disagree with you further. I don't mind. My cohort did very well. I'm very happy with
them. I'm glad to hear that. Lovely.
I've got 3 points, really. So my first one is that when I was working, before I was a teacher, I was an accountant, and I earned significantly more than I do now.
Yeah.
And at the time, my mum fell ill, and I covered my mum's mortgage payments to ensure that my mum had a house somewhere to live. Mm-hmm. And when my mum sadly passed away, I inherited that house. And I guess my point is that if inheritance tax was so much higher, where would be the incentive for me to cover my mum's mortgage and not rely on the state to find somewhere to help my mum live by selling her property or moving into social housing at that point? If we've got 100% inheritance tax.
Okay, so what's your second point?
My second point is that my other half, he is ex-military, has done very well for himself. He has got a severely disabled son who's in full-time residential care. Now, obviously, the send provision in this country is pretty appalling. Yeah. And he's built up something. And we've obviously got things in trust so that when my other half, you know, moves on and there's probably no provision for send at that point, his son will be looked after. Mm-hmm. But again, 100% inheritance tax means that that would not be there.
Well, I suppose the argument, just come back quickly on that one, Liz, would be that a tax like this would raise very substantial funds. So maybe that would fund better send provision for everybody.
I'd love to think that the governments would do that. I think you and I both know that that probably would not happen.
Well, at least it's a possibility. Because right now...
I guess my third point is that for those people who I don't think anyone, unless they are in that mega wealthy bracket, if we had different brackets for those people who are at the extreme end of wealth.
Yeah.
But I would imagine that there's a lot of family members of those who work on the family estate, and they probably work for free or for very limited in the knowledge that they will inherit.
Yeah.
So where again would be the incentive for them to work on their family
But my point, I mean, Liz, these are obviously all trade-offs, and I accept what you're saying, and that there will be particular cases. But right now, we're in a situation where people are having very little incentive, or less and less incentive, to work day to day, because taxes on income, marginal taxes on income, are rising so much and so quickly that basically, what is the incentive to work when we're alive? And my argument is that is a more important incentive to prioritise than the incentive to inherit something when our relatives are dead.
I do appreciate, obviously, the marginal, you know, the tax increases, because as I said, I'm a high school teacher.
Yeah.
And I'm a higher rate
taxpayer.
You'll
feel it. Absolutely. That's, and you shouldn't be.
Absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, it's mad.
It hasn't moved where it should do.
Absolutely.
However, I don't believe that there are, you know, when we're talking about that, about people who are not working because of what they're going to inherit, that is at the very top end, isn't it? The bulk of people are working, and then we're still saying you can't inherit that tiny part from their parents.
I agree, but if in my system, and you know, a system where we really aggressively taxed inheritance, that would raise tens and tens of billions of pounds. We could reduce income tax substantially. So you would be getting less money when you inherit, but you'd be earning more every single month. Isn't that a more equitable and better system?
I fully agree. I think you and I both know that the mega wealthy, who is the ones that we're wanting to target here, would still find a way around it.
All right, Liz in Bury St Edmunds there. I think my system, I don't know how they would find a way around it, because, I mean, they could move some of their assets abroad, I suppose, but certainly in terms of property and so on, it'd be very, very difficult to get around HMRC, because when you're dead, and you've got what you've got in the UK. Your thoughts on this, 0345 60 60 973. We'll be getting an update after the news about this question around the latest figures that have come out on asylum, pretty more generally negative figures for the government. First, though, at 10:30, let's get the LBC News headlines with Thomas Watts.
The number of asylum seekers being housed in hotels increased by 8% during Labour's first year in office. Figures show the total rose to 32,000, but were still far below the peak of 56,000 recorded under the Conservatives in 2023. Lucy Connolly, who was jailed for inciting racial hatred against asylum seekers, has been released from prison. The 42-year-old was given a 31-month jail sentence over a social media post on the day of the Southport murders. Figures show GCSE results are relatively stable compared to last year, despite an overall fall in the pass rate. Students across England, Wales and Northern Ireland have been picking up their grades this morning. LBC weather, a mixture of cloud and sunny spells, some isolated light showers in the north and east, a high of 21 degrees.
This is LBC.
Pump six in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Am I on a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6. T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
Arenas full of fans. Stars taking it to another level. The excitement, the glory, the action. And you could be behind it all. Kickstart your career in esports with Global Academy's new esports production sixth form course. Get the skills and knowledge to join a fast-growing media industry. And you can even join Global Academy's own esports team. Thinking what next after GCSEs? Then find out more about the esports production sixth form course at globalacademy.com.
At TfL, we're opening up more of London for everyone with step-free access. We're continuing to improve accessibility at many of our stations, and now over 200 stations and counting have step-free access, including the entire Elizabeth Line, DLR and all tram stops. That is how we're making the greener way to travel more accessible to all. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See Lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Time is 11:33. I can see that old monster, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, currently addressing some press conference or other, saying that Putin has said he's ready to meet Zelensky, but not yet. We'll, of course, keep an eye on that. I suspect it will never happen, but there we go. We'll keep an eye on what he's saying, the old serpent. And just, by the way, on this question of inheritance tax, these are not new ideas. These are old ideas. I mentioned Thomas Jefferson. Not often you get to quote John Stuart Mill on the radio on 11:30 on a Thursday morning, but here we go. It's something John Stuart Mill said in 1848. He said, the great liberal philosopher, the principle of inheritance is chiefly grounded on the duty of parents to provide for their children, but that duty has certain limits, and when these are exceeded, that right ceases. Beyond a certain point, to permit the transmission of enormous fortunes is nothing less than to establish a monopoly of wealth, and that is wholly opposed to the spirit of a free and equal society. Old JSM had it right then, and it's right now. Let's speak to Natasha, who's in Farnham. Natasha.
Totally agree with it, and that's why these rich people like the royal family and Duke of Westminster that you mentioned, it's absolutely shocking. And I'm sure there's many other people that aren't well known that get away with it. And it's like, how can this happen? You know, I totally agree with that quote. Well done for finding that.
Well, there we go. You agree with John Stuart Mill, our previous caller. That's nice to hear. Natasha, do you think that...
Yeah, and the lady that spoke before as well about the disabled child. You know, we're in that situation, my brother, and, you know, not everyone, like you said, can work and earn their own money. You know, there's all sorts of challenges that one might face. And as any parent would, you want to make sure your kids are looked after you've gone. What's wrong with that?
Yes, of course that's right. So, but wait, I thought you were. Are you in favour of inheritance tax or against it?
I'm talking about the extreme wealth. In favour of it.
Okay.
But they don't pay it. So, let's charge it to the people that don't pay it that should.
All right, Natasha in Farnham there. I mean, that is also always, of course, one of the slight problems with tax. Everyone's in favour of it on somebody else, but there we go. Let's take a break on that now and just have a look at these latest figures that have just come out about asylum in the last hour or two. New figures showing there were 32,059 asylum seekers in UK hotels at the end of June. That's up 8% on the same point 12 months ago. Natasha Clark, LBC's political editor, is with us. Natasha, would not be exactly welcome figures for the government given the events of the last 24 hours.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, with everything that's happening in Epping, with everything that's happening with Nigel Farage, Kemi Badenoch telling local councils in their own areas to look about whether they too can launch legal challenges about migrant hotels in their own area. That obviously comes after the Epping temporary injunction was granted earlier this week. Now, it's not a final decision, and I think some of those councils will probably be waiting for that final decision about whether they launch their own and on what grounds. And the Home Office are sort of a little bit worried about that, but equally they know that it is on a very small technicality about a planning decision, and that probably won't apply to all of these hotels across the country. I think what they may be worried about whether somebody decides to launch a bit more of a wider challenge. But yes, today, migration statistics out. It's fair to say there are a mixed bag. There's a few good things the government can point to in here. But, you know, the main top lines, there are more people coming over on small boats. There are more people that have come in the last year. Small boat arrivals accounting for 43,000 of all irregular arrivals in the last year. So this is the first year that Labour are in government. It's the first time that the Tories can say this is all under your watch, this is nothing to do with us. And of course we know that in the past they have been able to say we are cleaning up an inheritance that we inherited basically when we came into power. There are more people claiming asylum than ever before. That's a pretty damning statistic. So more than 110,000 people doing that in the last year, ending June 2025. But some good news
so
for the government.
That's an all-time high.
Yeah, it's an all-time high. It's bigger than the previous recorded peak, which is around 2002, around 103,000 people claiming asylum then. But some good news for the government. The cost of asylum is down. It was down 12% from a record £5.5 billion in 2023, now down to around 4.7. So that's good news. The government's spending less money on hotels. They say they're putting the more people into fewer hotels. Basically, they're consolidating them. They're putting more bunk beds and double beds in. So they're spending less money.
A little bit faster.
And they are processing people faster. They're getting people through the backlog a little bit quicker. At the end of June, there were 71,000 cases waiting a decision. That's down 18%. However, some really stark stuff in those statistics too, Lewis. More people claiming asylum after coming here legally on a visa. That's 13% of everybody who claims asylum now comes in legitimately on a visa. It might be a student visa, it might be a work visa or something like that, and then go on to claim asylum when it runs out. So that is the Home Office's new problem, right? It's not just small boats. It's not just people arriving across the channel, which is, of course, still a huge problem. But going forward, more and more people deciding to come here. And it's one Home Office source described this as it's total whack-a-mole, isn't it? Remember, we had people coming on the back of lorries. Then we had people coming on the back of boats. Now we are having people apply for migration, for asylum, rather, at the end of their visa too. So it's a real headache.
Well, indeed so, because although we focus a lot on the small boats because they are most visually there for all to see on the television screens night after night, 43,000 people coming over on small boats, 110,000 arriving overall claiming asylum, the clear majority, arriving by other means that we just don't see.
Exactly. It's not just small boats. It's far, far more than that. And yeah, there, of course, is a lot going on for the government. And they, like I say, they've got some wins to point to. They're obviously getting people through the backlog quicker. They say that they've taken the 1,000 people that were working on the Rwanda plan. They've put them back into clearing the backlog. But it just goes to show that, you know, even though they're doing better at that, the number of people is still rising and is still coming. And it's going to be a huge problem for years to come. And I think this vow that the government have made to close all the asylum hotels, come another year or two, that's going to be incredibly hard to meet, I think.
Might some people not suggest, Natasha, that Kemi Badenoch has a bit of a cheek writing to all of her council saying that she'll stand by them if they try and launch similar legal action? I mean, after all, it's not as if the asylum hotels was a Labour policy. I mean, it was a Conservative policy that's, I mean, it's gone through all sorts of governments, but I mean, you know, it actually reached its peak in September 2023 with 56,000 being in asylum hotels. She didn't have a problem with it then.
Well, I think everybody did have a problem with it then. But obviously, she's, what choice does she have, right? She has to slam the government at some point over their asylum hotels.
Yeah, but she doesn't have to encourage her own council leaders to start legal action against the government when she knows that that action, if it were to be successful, could result in many of those people ending up in the community or ending up goodness knows where. You know, you could say it's pretty irresponsible for a leader of the opposition to do.
Yeah, and I think, like I say, I think the Conservatives feel that they've got no choice as reformer chasing them on migration, but to continue to try to fight this ground, even though, as you say, you're completely right, it makes them look like total hypocrites to do something which was a problem and a mess under their government.
Would they have welcomed legal action when they were in government?
I'm sure they wouldn't. And yes, this is something that the Home Office and government sources I was speaking to this morning are really upset to see. It's saying, look, it's un-British to be, you know, pitting one area and one part of the country against another, saying it's not your problem, it's not our problem, you need to take these asylum seekers. And you know, it's London and I think the North West are the two areas of the country that are most affected per population. And of course, there are, you know, many councillors have been saying in the last 24 hours, of course this squeezes our local services, of course this is difficult for anybody to do. Local councils do have a you know, legal powers, they have to take some of these people. They have to spread them around the country. The sort of thing that the Home Office are now deciding what to do with is where do they put them if they can't put them in hotels? This was always seen as a last-ditch opportunity. Mm. They had to put them in hotels because there was nowhere else.
That's why Dan Jarvis, was when he was on the morning round yesterday, the security minister, when he was being pressed repeatedly by Tom Swarbrick, others as well, about where these people are going to go, he didn't have an answer, because the whole point is that asylum hotels are the accommodation of last resort.
Yeah, and actually, it's really interesting. Do you remember the liaison committee at the end of term? Keir Starmer said there's loads of accommodation.
Yeah, I mean, that was weird.
That's just not true, is it? If that was the case, why are you spending so much money putting them in hotels if you've got cheaper alternative accommodation? We know local councils, local authorities are really struggling. There's so many people on waiting lists as it is. There isn't. There is nowhere else to put them. And, you know, what's the alternative, right? You take them off at Kent and you just say, you give them some cash from the government and say, go and find your own hotel. That's not something that I don't think people want to see either. So the Home Office obviously have a huge job on their hands. They've got until the 12th of September, I believe, to find alternative accommodation for people at the Epping Hotel.
Or appeal
to it. I'm sure that, like I say, I think these reform councils, these Tory-led councils, will be watching that decision very closely. But I'm not sure that we are going to be seeing a flood of councils launch similar appeals, firstly, until that's gone, and secondly, about whether they know that there's going to be
some Labour councils apparently considering it as well.
Yes, we've obviously spoken to Wakefield Council today. They are very upset about asylum seeker hotels in their own area. They've not said they're going to be launching legal challenges just yet, but they are urging the government to go further and faster to get people out of those hotels and into more appropriate accommodation, they say. So yeah, this is just a problem that is not affecting Conservatives. It's not just affecting Reform, it's going to affect Labour councils too.
There's Sacha Clark there, LBC political editor, keeping us up to date with those figures. Obviously, we'll bring you any updates as they happen on the asylum issue throughout the day. It seems to be just moving ever faster. Abby is in Felixstowe, has something to say about inheritance tax. Abby, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Inheritance tax. I think Rachel Reeves is right to certainly look at perhaps increasing that. But we do, and I agree with other callers, we need to target those people who earn, who have a much, much higher income. They're really, really, really wealthy, of which there are a small minority, but they amass most of the wealth. But it's one piece of a much larger puzzle, isn't it, in terms of the Chancellor's job in finding more funding. And I think she's got a golden opportunity here to change the narrative and offer something more than just the Robin Hood rhetoric. She could, I know it's a bit socialist, but how about taking those people that are very, very wealthy, giving them an option to either pay more inheritance tax or to give back to the community through local funding initiatives? That would take the pressure off the local authorities and enable them to use their funding for more targeted local offers, like, for example, the SEND provision. And the people giving into the communities with their profit, their ridiculous amount of profit, are also then building a stake in the community that houses, for example, big entrepreneurs, that community that would house their sort of targeted demographic. That also makes the community more cohesive as well, and gives them that option. You can either pay this higher rate, or there are a whole load of initiatives. Choose one.
I think, Abby, the point is that I just keep coming back to is that, you know, we've got a decision as a society. We've got a decision. We can continue to increase rates of tax on ordinary people, just working, you know, earning modest incomes, or we can think seriously about how to reshape the tax system. But clearly what we're doing now at the moment, it's not working. It's not working. We're in a doom loop.
No. Yeah, I completely agree with that. That's why I say I completely agree. Something needs to change. But I think, you know, just saying, we need to tax the wealthy, it is not enough of a change. That has been pushed by government after government, and it's not making a difference. In fact, what's happening is that those wealthy people are finding loopholes and they're finding a ways around it, and leaving the country and taking their business with them, and our economy crashes because of that. So let's find a way to keep them by giving them an incentive to give back to the community, and in the same vein, and supporting the local authorities to be able to do more and offer more, because there's less pressure on them, because there's more being put in elsewhere.
That's Abby in Felixstowe there. What we've got to remember is, if we're looking at sort of high wealth individuals, when you're looking at their overall percentage they're paying each year, so James Dyson, there was a study by the Equality Trust, last year. Yes, paid a lot of tax, about 100 million or so. But in terms of overall wealth, it's about 0.68% of total wealth. So pay substantial sums, but still pays a small fraction of total assets. So Jim Ratcliffe was estimated, paid 0.59% of his wealth. That's 110 million in tax, so we're talking substantial. This is in 2018. Denise Coates is estimated in 2025 to have paid about £200 million. A lot of money, but it will be a relatively small part of her overall wealth, and that will go on and on and on. So, you know, in fairness, we're talking about substantial contributions to tax each and every year, and that is fair enough, and that ought to be acknowledged. The question is whether it is sufficient and adequate, given that the wealth is so big. And I keep coming back to this same point. We keep doing the same thing, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. We're taxing younger people more and more and more. We're taxing people on modest incomes more and more and more each year. Each year, more and more people dragged into the higher tax bracket on their income. That makes them, the irony is, that makes them less able to actually grow their own personal assets and wealth, whilst at the same time, those who already have wealth and assets, those assets continue to get more and more and more valuable. Look at the enormous increase in property prices and asset prices that took place over the course of the last decade as a result of quantitative easing, the QE program. Assets ballooning. And I'm not just talking about houses and property. I'm talking about anything that can hold wealth. Objets d'art, classic cars, everything. All of these things saw enormous increases in total asset value because of QE being pumped into the system. Those taxes, that wealth has been relatively untaxed at the same time that we're taxing ordinary people on their incomes that they're making each and every month more and more and more. Something's got to give. Something has got to give. And whether you agree with this or not, then come up with another idea. 0345 6060973. Listening to Lewis Goodall here on LBC, sitting in for James O'Brien. The time is 11:48.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
The Southport murderer, Axel Rudapkana, has won back privileges, including a TV and DVD player, apparently to encourage him to behave. He hurled boiling water at a guard in May. Shoaib Khan is a human rights lawyer.
I'm not sure why it's so newsworthy, to be honest. Luckily, it turned out, you know, I don't think the prison officer was particularly scalded. You know, he was.
He tried to throw boiling water at a prison guard.
Yes.
It doesn't matter whether he was hurt or not. That gives you an indication that this is a violent individual.
But I just don't see why, you know, depriving him of £10 extra for the canteen or...
This is a punishment. Here's the thing. If you act in a violent and disrespectful manner, you get punished for it.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast with Tom Swarbrick. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player and the new LBC app.
Would anyone like some Bourneville dark chocolate?
Is it so dark the aftertaste lasts for a week?
No.
Does it taste really... really complicated.
What?
Is it saturated in nibs?
So dark it comes with a therapist.
To the uneducated palate, does it taste like burnt tyre?
Would scientists compare the taste to dark matter?
Is it artisanal, in all caps?
Are the tasting notes gloom?
No, no pretentiousness, no complexity, no bitterness. Just smooth dark chocolate from Cadbury. Cadbury Bourneville. Made to be enjoyed, not endured.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family, get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, tap up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
Zero, nada, zilch. When Vauxhall say 0%, they mean 0%. 0% APR is available now across the Vauxhall car range, including the all-new Frontera Electric. With a minimum 20% deposit and up to 4 years on offer, what's not to like? And now, for a limited time, get an extra £500 towards your new Vauxhall. Search Vauxhall to find out more. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, £500 contribution on new car orders between 23rd of August to 8th of September 2025. 18 plus, subject to status and availability, T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
Tesco finest Sugar Bell tomatoes. The ultimate supporting act. Zinging up salads or elevating fresh linguine. Perfect for when you want to be vined and dined. It's why only the finest varieties are hand-picked when perfectly ripe to ensure our Sugar Bell tomatoes are exceptionally sweet. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
Who's a good human? Alex is. Because today's dog walk with Lulu the Corgi has turned into an off-grid adventure.
But wherever Lulu's nose takes her, Alex will always gladly follow. That's why he also chooses Butternut Box for Lulu's meals. Freshly prepared and served straight from the fridge, helping Lulu thrive from nose to tail. Meaning one less trek for Alex, as we deliver each box straight to your door. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Time is 11:52. Rob has texted to say, hi, Lewis. I think the answer is to put another tax band in for people who earn over 200,000 a year. It's taxed, i.e. taxed at 60%. Nobody needs to earn more than 200K a year. Rob, I can sort of see what you mean. And income is pretty unequally distributed. But I think that, again, I think that would be the wrong way to go about it. Because then we're just doing more and more to tax income rather than wealth. And again, let me just give you another statistic here and tell me how this is okay. Anybody? In the UK, the richest 1% hold around 230 times more wealth than the bottom 10%. 230 times. And you cannot tell me that inheritance is not basically one of the main drivers of inequality. If you don't have strong taxation, you just get wealth and privilege compounding down Generation A to Generation B to Generation C to Generation D, and you get an aristocracy of wealth. How can you not argue? How can you argue that that isn't the case? If you receive £200 million as an heir, it's just windfall. Even if we taxed it at 7%, 70%, definitely not 7%, even if we taxed it at 70%, you're still going to have an enormous amount of money. Huge. You're going to be really rich, and you didn't do a single thing to earn it. How can that be okay? Can anyone give me a moral case? Let's forget about the economy for a moment. A moral case as to why you should be able to inherit, say, £100 million or £200 million when you have done nothing to deserve it. You can contrast the fact that you can earn, just for doing nothing, you can just get £200 million or whatever it is, and you compare that to a teacher who is currently maybe paying 45% or 40% income tax. It's crazy. Tell me why I'm wrong. 0345 60 6097 3 84850. Turning to another matter now, something some of you will know, is of some interest to me personally. The Ministry of Defence has admitted there have been 49 separate data breaches in the past 4 years at the units handling relocation applications from Afghans seeking safety in the UK. Four of the 49 breaches were already publicly known, including, of course, the leak in 2022 of a spreadsheet containing details of almost 19,000 people fleeing the Taliban. Some of you will remember I was subject to a super injunction which prevented me from reporting that as far back as August 2023, so 2 years ago. The mammoth data breach, which of course led to thousands of Afghans being secretly relocated to the UK, an enormous cost, only revealed last month by myself and a team of other journalists who've been working on the story after the High Court finally lifted the gagging order. But now we've learned that there are even more than we knew about before. Adnan Malek is head of data head of data privacy at Barings Law, representing Afghans impacted by the breach. Adnan, thanks so much for joining us this morning. It just gets worse and worse, the Ministry of Defence on this.
It does. I mean, it just doesn't seem like the Ministry of Defence have learned the lesson the first time. It's happened nearly 50 times. What I think shocking as well is that the ICO have not taken any significant action. They took some action regarding the data breach of Afghans where the email addresses were breached. But something more significant as the data breach you've mentioned, the ICO have done nothing about it. And if the Ministry of Defence are not being held accountable, the onus isn't on them to ensure that they bring in changes that are long-lasting. It just seems to be one thing after the other. I mean, 50 data breaches, one organisation experiencing them in the last couple of years is absolutely unprecedented and unheard of.
And we should remind listeners, Adnan, that despite the fact, and I continue to find this astonishing, despite the fact that we had that catastrophic data breach, let's just take the one concerning the 19,000 people. That catastrophic data breach, it's cost potentially billions of pounds to the Ministry of Defence, and it's going to cost way more by the time compensation, by the time people like yourself are through with the government compensation. There is no question at the moment of having any sort of public inquiry into it. We're just being asked to just sort of sail on regardless. That's leaving aside all of these other data breaches about which we're just learning.
That's correct. So approximately £2.5 million was spent by the government on legal costs in keeping the super injunction in place.
I know. I was at those hearings. I could see how many lawyers they had week after
week. Likewise, they had a team of barristers and solicitors. There's no need for it. This should have been lifted much earlier. A public inquiry should be taking place, not only to look at the financial implications, but how this keeps happening over and over again. If this was a private organization, there would be people who would be quitting, people who would be held accountable. The Ministry of Defense should be no different to this. They are essentially holding data that they're being provided in some categories of people who are at a very high risk, some people who could pay with their lives, and nothing is being done about it. It just simply can't go on.
It's very clear, isn't it, Adnan? It's got to be clear at this point that the Ministry of Defense's information systems and processes, they're clearly just not fit for purpose.
I agree. I mean, 49 breaches over a scheme that only started a couple of years ago is, I mean, you'll run out of words to describe it. It's over 10 breaches a year. It's just simply astonishing that the Minister of Defence, in their comment to the BBC, have said that they take data protection very seriously. I mean, if 49 breaches isn't enough, I'm not sure how many more breaches that need to occur for them to change something.
And we should say, I mean, the MOD has so far refused to provide any details of the nature of each of these breaches. But incidents which have obviously previously been made public include officials inadvertently revealing the email addresses or other personal details of applicants to third parties. And we should say the reason, certainly, that that massive data breach was a problem, and I suspect that this one could be as well. Ultimately, what we're dealing with here is people who could be at risk from the Taliban if they're already in Afghanistan. So these breaches, they're not just, you know, sometimes we hear about data breaches from companies in the UK or whatever, and obviously, you know, personal details in that regard are annoying or potentially worse than annoying, but nonetheless. But in this case, we're talking about potential risk to life.
That's correct. What one needs to understand is the individuals who are on this spreadsheet, they assisted the Ministry of Defense. You know, the Ministry of Defense was in Afghanistan. These people were living there. They were assisting our armed forces. There was a promise that they would be brought here for one reason or another. Some have come here, some haven't. Their lives are now at risk, and they're saying, look, we held our bargain up. We need to be brought to safety. We receive emails regularly from clients who are based in Iran, in Afghanistan, and other countries to say, look, our lives are at risk. We need to be removed from here. The Taliban are coming looking for us. I sent a video last week that clearly showed individuals with guns going through the house. And the person who sent this video to us, he said, look, my brother was on the list and they're here looking for him and looking for other people. So there are very real consequences as a result of this breach.
What, I mean, how many clients are you now representing, Adnan?
Just shy of 1,500.
So you're representing just shy of 1,500 clients who say that they've been affected by these various breaches. And they're all looking for compensation?
Yes. Additionally, also, we want to ensure that the Ministry of Defense changes the way they handle data. So that's going to be something we're going to be seeking, asking them to show us how they're going to improve their systems in place to ensure data breach of this nature doesn't happen again.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? It continues to someone who's followed it very closely, the mind continues to boggle. Adnan Malik there, head of data privacy at Barings Law, representing Afghans impacted by that breach. If you think you've heard the last of that story, think again, because partly as a result of the efforts of people like Adnan at Barings, there are going to be an absolute slew of compensation cases with regards to these data breaches. Someone put it to me a couple of weeks ago, you know, imagine you were going to have 19,000 people who had been in a witness protection program and their data had been compromised. That's the gravity. That's how serious the courts will take it. We've never seen anything like it before. It's going to be a sort of PPI for people who were caught up in the Afghan occupation, the Afghan situation that we had for 20 years with the British Army and the Americans there. We're never going to see anything like it. And the cost of the British government to us is going to be absolutely enormous. We've just hit midday on LBC. We'll be continuing our inheritance tax discussion, given that so many of you have got so much to say about it. But I think it's important discussion to have because it links into so many bits of our contemporary politics and the run-up to that crucial budget in October. But for now, you're listening to me, Lewis Goodall, here on LBC. The time is 12 o'clock.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, there has been an increase in both asylum claims and the number of migrants being housed in hotels. The hotel total rose to 32,000 in the year to June, but was still far below the peak of 56,000 recorded in September 2023. LBC's political editor is Natasha Clark.
That is up 8% on the same month 12 months ago. And also it shows more than 111,000 people claiming asylum in the UK to the same time period. So that's 14% more than the year before and 8% more than the previous peak. The Tories have hit out at Labour this morning, but it's fair to say that obviously a huge amount of this happened under their watch too. It is a problem the government have very much inherited.
Ministers are braced for more legal challenges after the High Court ruled asylum seekers should be removed from a hotel in Epping. A woman jailed for stirring up racial hatred on the day of the Southport murders has been freed from prison. Lucy Connolly was given a 31-month sentence last October over a post in which she called for people to set fire to migrant hotels. Her case led to a free speech debate, with some criticising the term as excessive. An American woman has been jailed for 30 years over a failed assassination in Birmingham. Amy Betrow's plot was foiled when her gun jammed during the bungled shooting in September 2019. The 45-year-old was convicted of conspiracy to murder earlier this month. A Ukrainian man suspected of plotting attacks on the Nord Stream gas pipeline in 2022 has been arrested in Italy. Prosecutors believe he was part of a group who set sail from the coast of Germany to plant explosive devices on the pipes in the Baltic. England's exams regulator Ofqual says the latest set of GCSE results are stable. Some 67.4% of grades were a 4 or better, representing a slight fall in the overall pass rate. Hundreds of thousands of pupils have been picking up their marks, including these teenagers.
I'm looking forward to going to college and smash it, but you just have to believe yourself.
It feels very relieving. It's like a weight off my shoulders now. I can like breathe now.
A lot of work went into it, especially art. Art was my biggie, but all the other ones, a lot of work, a lot of studying.
In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was at 92.60. That's down 27. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 15. LBC weather this afternoon. Most places seeing a mixture of cloud and sunny spells. A few isolated showers in the north and west. A high of 21 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Hey, Dad.
Hey, love. Just spoke to Zara from St. James's Place.
Your financial advisor?
Yeah, we've made a plan. Retire early, travel more. Peru first.
Ooh, ¿cómo estás?
Bless you. And Zara's plan means I can help more with your house deposit.
Thanks again, Dad.
Planning for the future calls for invaluable advice. Visit St. James's Place to find your one-to-one financial advisor. St. James's Place Wealth Management PLC is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. SJP approved 19th of Feb 25.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12:04. For those asking where Mystery Hour is, to be honest, it's such a mystery to me. I don't know. There's no point doing it. So we're just going to continue this conversation instead about inheritance tax, because I can see it's got a lot of you animated. And I think it's a conversation I really want to have, because I just think that we are stuck in a doom loop in Britain at the moment, and we need to think radically. And part of that radicalism is to consider, as I say, these are old ideas. It is something that in the 19th century, people, political philosophers were talking about, political theorists were talking about, John Stuart Mill, Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, you know, you name it. This was an idea which was alive. The idea that the land should belong to the living and not the dead. That we should not be subject to the whims and contingencies and decisions of our forebears long since past. Because that ultimately is what wealth is. It is a stock of the decisions that someone else has made over years or decades or centuries. And I think that if you believe in a meritocracy, which I do, I believe in a merit-based society, that extreme wealth and extreme inherited wealth is incompatible with that idea. Again, before we continue the conversation, some stats. The top 10% of households hold 57% of all wealth. The bottom 50% own less than 5%. The top 1% alone, according to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation and the Office for National Statistics, control 23%, nearly a quarter of all wealth in Britain. Inheritances, meanwhile, are soaring and set to soar as the baby boomers, who enjoyed very considerable increases in asset prices over the course of their lives, particularly homes, pass on and are set to pass it on down the generations. Inheritances are projected to double from $100 billion a year in 2020 to $200 billion a year by 2040. Half of all wealth in the UK, half, is now inherited rather than earned. That is up from about 25% in the 1970s. By the 2030s, two-thirds of young adults are expected to rely on family wealth to buy homes. Wouldn't it be so much better to cut the income taxes on their work than expecting or hoping to have the genetic lottery of someone passing it on to them? The UK's inheritance tax take is lower than our peers. France and Belgium, for example, collect more than 1% of GDP from inheritance. And some of the wealthiest, most dynamic societies on earth, like Japan or South Korea, have high rates of inheritance tax precisely because they want to stop the growth of dynastic wealth. Children of the wealthiest 20% are seven times more likely to remain in the top 20% than adults from the poorest fifth are likely to get there. Why? Because their wealth compounds wealth. Even if the children from the bottom 20% do well, they have no real hope of ever, even if they work hard and they're brilliant, they are so much less likely to ever get into the top 20% because the wealth of the top 20% just keeps chasing away from them. Because wealth begets wealth. Wealth makes wealth. And increasingly, income does not make wealth because it's taxed so heavily. So why don't we shift the system towards wealth and inheritance and away from work? 0345 6060973. We've got a first-time caller here. I think Gohar, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who has called from Lewisham. Gohar, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Goodall. Thank you for taking my call. First-time caller, many years a listener.
Oh, fantastic. Well, good. I'm glad that this has provoked you to pick up the phone. What would you like to say?
I've been provoked for a few days now because it's not just yourself who's talking about inheritance tax, but Tom Swarvik, other presenters also talking about this. My question is this. I live with my wife and my young daughter with my father. My mother passed away this March.
I'm sorry to
now,
hear that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. The threshold is £1 million.
Yeah.
If the property goes to over £1 million, where are my wife and I supposed to find £400,000 to pay the tax man?
But it's not over £1 million. It's tax for every pound over £1 million. So you don't suddenly go, right, we've got to pay £400,000 now. You've just got to pay, say if it's 1.1 million, then you'd pay 40,000.
But where are we going to find 40,000 even? I've got 2 degrees, a BA honours and a master's, and I don't even earn the London Living Wage.
Well, I suppose people would say, Gohar, that you could release some of the equity from the house, that you could sell a house, you could buy another house. I mean, actually getting a windfall. I mean, obviously, it would be awful for your father to die. And of course, that would be awful. Obviously, it happens to everyone in the end. But I suppose some people would say that
he's 89, he's elderly.
Of course.
Come on.
Yeah.
He's not going to live forever. We're all going to go sooner or later.
No, of course.
We?
But what I'm saying is, I suppose some people might say that if you get a windfall of £1 million, that's quite a nice problem to have.
No, but with a family home, it should be abolished. If a person has more than one property and they're renting it out and making an income from it, by all means. But the family home, I firmly believe, inheritance tax should be abolished.
Why?
Because it's the family home. We're not making money out of it. It's not a business.
But say, like, you had the sort of, I don't know, say you had a duke somewhere, therefore, and they had some, you know, massive, massive manor house or castle or whatever, and they say, well, that's our family home. You think that should be exempt from inheritance tax?
Yeah, if they're living there, of course.
Why?
I'm not. We're not making it as a means of income. And
but eventually someone will. But Gohar, eventually someone will
get rid of inheritance tax.
But Gohar, someone will at some point. You're not going to live in it forever.
Well, then it should be passed on to my children if they're living there.
But why?
It's their family. It's a family home. That's my point.
But I know.
But would agree.
But I'm sure. I'm sure they would.
As you said. Sorry to interrupt you. As you said, 1.1 million. If it goes to 1.4 million. Where are we going to find £400,000 from?
Well, it wouldn't be £400,000. It would be £160,000. But what I'm saying to you is that... and you keep saying it's a family home, and I understand that, and I know that has emotional resonance for a lot of people. I get it.
It's our roof over our head.
I know, but I'm just trying to drill down. Like, just because it's a family home, why do you think it should be exempt from inheritance tax?
Because it's a family home.
No, I know it's a family... I'm asking, but why?
It's a roof over our head. It's not a means of income.
It's not a means of income, okay, fine. But why, just because it's a family home, given that it's a very valuable asset, should it be exempt from an all inheritance tax?
because it's a family home. That's my point.
Anyway, we're in a bit of a circular trap, I feel. But I know it's a family home, but it might not be a family home forever. You might choose to move out of it and sell it, and lots of people do.
Okay, if we sell it, then we pay the tax on it. That's not a problem. But while we're living there, as a family, it should be not non-taxable.
But what do you think of my argument overall, Gohar, which is to say that we need to be moving the burden of taxation from income towards wealth?
For those, for example, there's a lot of hue and cry about billionaires or millionaires leaving this country, right?
Well, yeah, but I think a lot of that is quite exaggerated, to be honest, Gohar.
Exactly. Well, you've got certain people on the right who you know very well who I'm talking about, who are saying, oh, millionaires are leaving this country in their droves. If they leave, let them leave. Others will come and replace them, mm-hmm. right? You know, the cake is big enough for everybody. And, for example, the likes of your Radcliffe's and your Dysons and all these people who are multi-billionaires who have made all their money from this country, why should they be exempt from wealth tax?
Well, I agree with that entirely. I do agree with that. Gohar and Lewisham, grateful for your contribution. Look, I know that the idea that the family home, I know it's emotive, but ultimately, it's also true to say that it's a nice problem to have to receive a £1 million house. And I know it might be your family home or whatever, but there are options that you have available. It's not like the current system says, right, okay, you, as I think, again, it sort of betrayed some of the myths around this, around the current system, which is the idea that somehow you have to pay 40p in the pound everything you don't. No, like you get £1 million basically that's completely tax exempt, which is not a bad position to be in. Richard, as Tech said, of course, scumbag socialist Goodall, interesting start, is advocating higher inheritance tax on families. Ironic, given his private education. Comp boy here, Richard. Actually, comprehensive school educated, so you're just completely wrong. So how's your IQ doing? Michael is in Bushy. Michael, what have you got to say?
Good afternoon, Lewis.
Good afternoon.
I agree with you where we say we're in a circle of doom, especially when you've got Rachel from Accounts and you're coming up with similar ideas. Basically,
it's not very. What Rachel from Accounts? Some people think that's rather offensive, quite sexist thing to say, Michael. But there we go.
Well, put it this way: there are stories, but I'm not going to go into that. What I'm saying, right, with regards to inheritance tax, I think you should go and live in a communist society, because what you're trying to do is redistribute wealth.
Yep.
I agree that a lot of people have worked hard all their life and they've paid for their properties and inheritance. And
do you think 1920s England was a communist society?
No, I didn't say it was a communist society. What I'm saying, these people have worked hard and they've invested their money in
Michael, you're accusing me of saying I should go and live in a communist society, and I'm advocating basically communism. Inheritance taxes were higher in 1920s Britain than they were today. So do you think 1920s Britain was a communist
property
society?
Property values and everything, property values weren't as high then. And what I'm saying to you is,
it's the principle. The value is neither here nor there. It's the principle, isn't it? Likewise, after the 1940s, we had much higher inheritance tax. And guess what? In both periods, our economy was more dynamic, there was more meritocracy, there was more social cohesion, and there was more social mobility.
Yes, but I agree what you're saying, that inheritance tax needs to be changed, yes, but not as high as what you're suggesting.
Well, sure, yes. Okay. Fine, we can have a debate about the threshold, for sure, but at the moment, it is, my contention would be, too low, and we need to move away from taxes on income to taxes on unearned income via wealth.
Well, unearned income is paid at 40% capital gains tax. What you could also do, if you want to raise taxes...
Capital gains is at 25%.
But they could raise that up a bit higher.
Right, OK, yeah. Well, that's certainly an idea.
The other thing is, obviously, that if you look at it, council tax, they could raise money on council tax. Because if you've got a house...
But that's regressive.
Yeah, it's regressive, but what I'm saying to you, if somebody's got a house worth $1 million or $2 million, why should they be paying in a higher rate band as somebody who's only got a house worth 400,000.
But the problem with the council, I mean, I agree with you in principle, Michael, but then the problem with the council tax, obviously, is that it's such an imperfect system because it's based on property valuation of the early 1990s, because no government has dared to look at it again since. So I think just sort of adding extra bands, you're just compounding an imperfect system. Far better to look at wealth taxation in the round, including inheritance tax, including property taxation, and come up with something new.
I think, you know, inheritance tax might need to be changed. But as the previous caller said, losing the family home is one. Why shouldn't I work hard, which I've done all my life, and decide to give my children an inheritance?
But why should people who should work hard all their lives pay less as a percent or more as a percentage of their income just because they haven't happened to be in a position to inherit anything from anybody than people who do inherit things from their parents and grandparents for which they have done nothing to earn it?
I disagree with you there. But the other thing, if you want to raise money, it's like other countries, you keep mentioning European countries. Let's take America. Some on a lottery, if you win the lottery in America, you pay tax.
Yeah, okay, fine. But I mean, I'm not sure America, with its massive wealth and income inequalities, is necessarily something we should be aiming for. Michael in Bushy there. Again, I just keep coming back to this. I can see that there is a moral, and political argument to say that you have the right to use some of your income to give stuff to your children, or give money to your children. I can see that, and I'm saying 100% inheritance tax is a bit provocative. I wouldn't be against it, but I can see why many people would be. I would be in favour of something lower. I don't see the argument as to why one has a right to inherit. What is the moral right to inherit rather than to give? What is the moral right for that? Why should you expect something? People talk about the right to expect something from their parents or their grandparents. And what about the rights of others not to end up living in a society where wealth has created such an aristocracy of wealth that they don't have a fair shot? And I would certainly be in favour of increasing rates of inheritance tax, tapering it, and getting up to maybe something close to 100% on the really big top estates. Because we've got to do something. I keep coming back to it. We've got to do something. The current society we're living in, we are stuck in a doom loop. So it's time to think radically. What is the moral right to inherit? 0345 6060973. You're listening to Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien on LBC, where the time is 12:17.
This is LBC.
Pump six in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Am I on a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6. T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/lptv. Offer ends 27th of August.
Buying a home on a holiday park was a dream that became a nightmare. High pressure sales tactics, huge site fee increases, and a loss of value have left many customers feeling misled, angry, and trapped. But the Holiday Park Advice Centre can help. Contact us today and we'll help claim back any money you're owed on your holiday home. Text ASSIST to 78900 to get started.
Hello, Holiday Park Advice Centre.
That's ASSIST to 78900.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 12:19. Some more stats for you on this. Total household wealth in the UK is now estimated at £15 trillion. That is more than seven times the UK's annual GDP. That shows just how much resource is sitting in private assets rather than the productive economy. Average inheritance in the 2020s is 136,000. That's projected to rise to 260,000 by the 2040s. By 2035, the typical inheritance will be worth half of average UK wealth. But that, of course, is deeply unevenly distributed because the wealthiest 20% of families account for almost 70% of all inheritances. So despite you get people coming on phone-ins like this going, oh, I'm worried I'm going to be hit by inheritance tax and whatever, it's currently applied only to 4% of the very wealthiest estates. So we are looking at a situation where we are struggling for resources, we're taxing people too much on their income, and yet UK housing wealth alone now exceeds £8 trillion. At a time where home ownership among the early under 35s has collapsed from 65% to 28% today. Basically, inheritance, and we're getting this on the phones. People are saying, well, I need to inherit my home from my parents. That's the problem. If that is exactly the problem that you, the only hope that you have of getting a house is to inherit it from your mum and dad, is the problem. And that's why we've got to do something new, because that would not have been the case as recently for most people as recently as the 1990s. So we've got to do something new. And if I'm wrong, what is it? Ray is in Vauxhall. Ray, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Rich. Yeah, a couple of points to make. Firstly, the point you made actually about this 4% of the taxpayers actually paying inheritance tax, I was going to pick that up straight away, but from a reverse angle, because I think this argument is being made from the point of view of rhetoric, and often left-leaning arguments are, without understanding the practicalities of the matter.
I think there's a fair few arguments on the right that are made from points of rhetoric as well, Ray,
to be fair. Well, I'm trying to take the middle ground then. Let's put it like that. So, I mean, because a lot of Rachel Reeves' policies, and a lot of the sort of, feels like a lot of media leaks of policies she's suggesting about property and wealth taxes are sort of, she doesn't really have a direction. She's just feeling out the audience to find, to figure out, you know, what would stick, what would land well. And that's why we're getting these news reports every week. She doesn't really have a strategy, it doesn't appear to me.
I agree with that.
Yeah, so in terms of the inheritance tax, I agree, actually, that it's a nonsense that only 4% of the country pay it. But I have the opposite view to you, is that I don't think, rather than scaling it up, I think it should be scaled down, as in the tax rate should come down on the inheritance tax, but the amount of people that pay it should be widened. So the rate, the threshold should be lowered. I made this point to James O'Brien on a previous week, where if the threshold was dropped to 150,000 and everyone paid, let's say, you know, 10% inheritance tax, the tax intake would increase and the wider population would pay it rather than just a few people in London and the South East, which is what inheritance tax basically is, a tax on London.
Yes.
So that's the first thing.
Well, it would. It would, although, I mean, presumably, I mean, I would argue that, I mean, yes, you're right. If your purpose is to increase tax take, that would obviously be an effective way of doing
it. That is the purpose, yeah.
That's it, yeah. But although, well, yeah, up to a point, but my other objective with this would be to shift the burden of taxation to wealth rather than income, and also to ensure that hyper wealth does not emerge to create what which we've got at the moment, which is basically an aristocracy of wealth. So a flat rate for everybody wouldn't really help with that third objective in particular.
Right. Well, I agree or disagree with that, with your assertion there. I agree that hyper wealth is not a good thing for the country. I mean, the most recent large shift of assets was at the Queen, you know, the Queen and Prince Philip's death. $15 billion worth of assets shifted down without any inheritance tax paid because they are exempt under statutory law. But, you know, on a wider point about wealth taxes, the reason why wealth taxes are not prevalent across the world is because they don't work. And income is a much easier form of of tax intake. That's the first thing, practically speaking.
But inheritance tax is the most effective form of wealth taxation because it's the hardest to avoid. So if you were to tighten it up and expand it would work.
It still can be avoided, and can be avoided easier than income taxes can be avoided, which is why a lot of the world has scaled back for wealth taxes.
It would be very hard to avoid a tax, the sort of which I was proposing, at the high rates it's proposing, because so much of our wealth as a country is bound up in property, and ultimately avoid that.
Let me suggest this. A lot of people don't know this, and I say a lot of new Labour voters wouldn't have been born the last time Labour introduced a wealth tax in the 70s, and it didn't work because the tax take dropped when a 90% rate of tax was there on UNAC.
Yeah, but what I'm proposing, which is tightening up and increasing inheritance tax and shifting that burden towards inheritance, did work. It has worked. It worked in the 1920s when rates were much higher today, when it was called the estate duty, and it was worked in the 1970s as well when it was much higher today. So you're right, there are other forms of wealth taxation which are harder because that wealth is more mobile, but inheritance tax is more difficult to avoid.
Well, in terms of property, I think, you know, there are various schemes that have always been used in inheritance tax. There's trust schemes. There's various options that people have. They have a long time to plan for inheritance tax. That's the point, for tax planning point of view.
Only if you allow exemptions at the moment like you have with the 7 years. If you get rid of all of that, very hard to plan around it because ultimately it is what it is.
Or the property just gets sold and the cash gets moved offshore, abroad, which is what happens, alternatively.
Well, perhaps, but I mean, there are all sorts of ways that you can... I mean, the point is that, and you say that wealth taxation doesn't always work. It's not always true either. I mean, there are examples, the Norwegians have introduced a wealth tax recently. It is generating money. Yes, there's some people moving offshore, but it does generate money. So, you know, ultimately, this is something that we have got to grapple with. Ultimately, because at the moment, my point raised is that wealth is becoming so, so concentrated. We are looking at, we're getting back to a sort of late 19th century situation where you have the sort of Gilded Age, where you have sort of big, big monopolies of wealth, effectively. And we are shifting so much of our overall GDP away from productive income which ordinary people can enjoy every single day, and towards assets which are on unearned income, that we've got to do something, because at the moment all we're doing is taxing income higher and higher and higher, more and more and more, and we're going to hit a breaking point with it.
Well, I agree with that, and my solution is sort of what I started at the call was, because what I was suggesting about, for example, property, when somebody buys a property, they pay stamp duty, they pay interest, they refurbish that property, they invest in that property, they extend it, they improve it, and then they pay capital tax if they sell it. Now, or they pay inheritance tax when they pass it down. So that property has been taxed many, many times through its life. So it's not that it's just an unearned, untaxed entity. But the point I'm making is that I think people should pay tax on inheritance, and that's where we tax the wealth that you're talking about, but it should be at a lower rate and a much broader scale across the country.
All right, Ray in Vauxhall there. Just some stats, for example, on the Norwegian wealth tax, which has been introduced. And wealth tax is now raising for Norway about 15 billion Norwegian kroner a year. That's about £1 billion or so, just over £1 billion. That's approximately 1.1% of total tax revenue, and about 0.5% of GDP. Another comparative source estimates Norway's wealth tax is now accounting for about 1.5% of total tax revenue, in line with similar metrics reported for Switzerland, which also has a wealth tax. So when people say it doesn't work, yeah, there are always going to be effects, and there are always going to be people who move as a result of it. The key is to have, I think, an overall package of taxation which rewards work. Because, by the way, as well, if these wealthy people choose to work more, and they choose to do something with their income, and they choose to invest in businesses and so on, and do something productive with their wealth rather than just hoard it, then guess what? They will actually end up paying less tax on their income, and hopefully even on some of their capital gains, which we'll be able to reduce as well, and on their corporation tax, perhaps, on productive uses of the economy, rather than just storing it all up in wealth. So it benefits everybody, even the wealthy, while they're alive. Rather, just basically, you're taxing their ability to pass on crazy amounts of wealth to whomever they so please after they're dead, which I'm not sure why is such a kind of taboo to talk about in this country. Janet is in Brighton. Janet, good afternoon.
Yeah, I just think you're being really cruel in what you're saying. Yeah, I do, actually.
Why is it
and
cruel?
I'll tell you why. I've been nursing since 1973. I've never been able to afford to not nurse. I sadly was left and had to bring up my children on my own when they were very young. And it was only because, sadly, I lost my dad recently that I've been able to pay off my mortgage.
Right. Well, I'm very sorry to hear that you lost your dad, Janet.
But yes, and I've been able to pay off my mortgage. Now, the point is, I can now reduce the hours I'm nursing. I'm now doing childcare to help one of my daughters out because childcare is so expensive. I've never been able to spoil them. I never go out for meals. I don't go on holidays. I just work. And I'm well over retirement age. And I'm just so hacked off because, do you know what? My kids are fantastic. One of them is a teacher now.
What's that got to do with anything, Janet? I'm sure they are.
She can't get on the property ladder.
Yes, exactly.
Hang on a minute.
You're making my point for me.
Hang on. No, you're not. No, you're not listening to me. You're interrupting. What I'm going to say is that the one thing that cheers me up is that at some point I'm going to die. And when that happens, at least, no, it doesn't. What it does do, it makes me feel that at least, and because we live in the southeast, that's just how it was and is. I have a house, a very small, ordinary house, but it happens to be worth a lot of money. It's worth over the 350,000 that is when you start paying inheritance tax. And so, you know, I just get pleasure from thinking, well, at least at the long last, they're used to not having any money. We're all used to not having any money. I've never had any form of, extra help from the government, you know, other than child credit. I have never been on any form of income support or anything like that. I'm very fortunate and I'm grateful for that. But I think what you're saying, you're inferring that because I have a house that, because I live in the southeast, is worth a reasonable amount of money, that I'm this rolling in bloody rich person. And yet I don't go out for meals. I bet you do. I bet you go on nice holidays. I don't.
Janet.
I think you're cruel and very...
Okay, Janet, Janet, can I just put a couple of counterpoints to you, right? In a respectful way. And I hope that you see that I'm not cruel. I would say that you've met, your kids can't afford a house. You're making my point
for me. One of them can.
Okay.
The other one can't because she's a single person on her own.
Yeah. And I bet she's paying very high rates of income tax. High rates of income. No, just let me finish.
Like
Janet, you've had your say. Let me just come back, okay? And then you can come back again. She's going to be paying higher and higher rates of income tax. That is because, as an economy overall, we are taxing wealth too little because it's a bigger and bigger part of our economy, and taxing working people too much. Now, wouldn't it be better for your daughter, but also all of the other people's sons and daughters who perhaps aren't as fortunate to be in a position to inherit wealth or inherit a house, to be in a position where the government had enough money to fund the actual construction of enough homes for everyone, number one, and B, when they have done so, for your daughter to be in a position that she is not paying so much of her income month after month to be able to save for a deposit to buy a house rather than just waiting for you with respect to die?
No. I completely
You don't think that would
disagree.
Be better? Okay.
No,
well,
I completely disagree.
Then we are
disagree.
In a fundamental point of disagreement, Janet, and we just have to, I suppose, accept that. Janet from Brighton there, who apparently thinks that it would be better to be in a world where basically you're just in the genetic lottery of hoping for your parents to die and give you some money rather than be in a position where everybody can afford to buy a house because we're in a healthy economy where income is, you know, properly shared around and not everybody has all the wealth. But there we go. I mean, you know, each to their own. LBC News headlines, 12:32, Amelia Cox.
The number of asylum seekers being housed in hotels has risen in a year, but is still far below the peak under the previous government. 32,000 people were staying in hotel accommodation in the year to June, and there were also more asylum claims. A woman jailed for stirring up racial hatred against asylum seekers on the day of the Southport stabbings has been freed from prison. Lucy Connolly, who is the wife of a Tory councillor, was jailed for 31 months in October and has been released after serving a third of her sentence. And an American woman has been jailed for 30 years over the failed assassination of a man in Birmingham in September 2019. 45-year-old Amy Betrow was convicted of conspiracy to murder earlier this month. LBC weather staying largely cloudy for northern and central England this afternoon. Sunny spells developing elsewhere. The odd spot of drizzle in eastern coastal areas, a high of 21 degrees.
This is LBC.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Top up on island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours too. I. Inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with TRIP.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
You've arrived, your dream holiday. You got there for less thanks to comparing flight prices on Kayak. An idyllic local restaurant nestled in the cliffs. A peaceful pool with your own private sunbed. This is the life. All you have to do is actually book it. Don't holidays. Use Kayak to compare flight prices from hundreds of travel sites and bag a great deal. Search Kayak. And go see for yourself.
Daniel liked how easy it was to transfer his old pensions to PensionBee.
I've had quite an eclectic career, and with that I'd amassed pensions from a couple of different providers. I signed up using the app. It was really straightforward. I was able to give them a couple of key facts about each of my pensions, and then PensionBee did the rest of the work for me.
At PensionBee, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to PensionBee.com. And be pension confident. When investing, your capital is at risk.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 12:35. Linda's text say, Lewis, regarding your caller Janet, I agree completely with her. Why do people not applaud people who've made something or done well in the UK? Linda, that's my whole point. I want people who are doing well while they're alive as a result of their own efforts and application and hard work and endeavours to profit more from their endeavours, because they've earned it. They've merited it. They've done something toward it, as opposed to a situation where just the best hope in this country, which is supposed to be a democracy, which is supposed to be a place where if you work hard, you can get on in life, as opposed to a world where the best chance you have of having some stability and financial stability and having a property of your own is to inherit it from your mum and dad because they just so happen to have a house in a certain place. That can't be. Is that the British dream? Is that the best we can hope for? The genetic roll of the dice? Is that a moral place to live in? I want to celebrate, and that should give more of people's money to people while they're alive. I want to incentivize them to work harder, not just sit there and wait around for their mum and dad to shuffle off this mortal coil so they get to live in their house together forever. What kind of vision for a society is that? I don't get it. I don't understand it. Maybe it's because I've never inherited anything, and there is no chance for various reasons of me inheriting anything either. Maybe it's because of that. I don't know. But I do think at least it allows me to see things with a little bit of clarity and a little bit of precision rather than going, oh, no, it's going to affect me. Well, well, well. Alex is in Fulham. Alex, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm all right.
First time caller, this topic really invokes a lot of me. So I'm an entrepreneur. I'm building an AI company in the UK.
Amazing. Good for you.
And it's very scary when the narrative is always targeting now the wealthy. I'm not wealthy myself, but I aspire to be. I've been taking a salary sacrifice for 5 years to build something from the ground up. The issue is, if you target the wealthy, you're going to disincentivize people like me who are building companies in the UK.
But why, Alex? I'm not, because I'm going to incentivize. We're going to reduce your levels of taxation. We're going to reduce the tax on your income. We're going to reduce your capital gains, because what we're going to do is take it off unearned income from when people die, just passing on big estates. So we're going to actually incentivize you to work harder, and we're going to incentivize your employees to work harder, because they're going to make more out of every pound that they earn.
So here's the thing. Every human is hardwired to provide for their children. If you punish that instinct, you're going to weaken the drive. Let me explain. If my company goes to $1 billion, right? It could.
What, with a bill of luck?
I don't decide the number. All I want to do is grow something successful. And in response, that's going to pay corporation taxes and make employees wealthy, etc.
Yep.
If the UK does these inheritance taxes, I will relocate, because I want to pass my wealth to my family.
Well,
and Alex, that's human nature.
Alex, let's just say that, obviously it would be a kind of ridiculous number, but I hope it happens. I really do, because I believe in income generation. I believe in all. I want the country to do well. So let's say you were to pass on £1 billion as an estate. And let's say we put inheritance tax is, let's say, I don't know, 70%. Would it be such a big disincentive thinking,
yes,
oh, I'm going to pass
yes.
on 300 million to
I'm
my
thinking...
kids rather than 500 million or 600 million?
No, I'll explain to you why. So I don't look down just to my children. I'm looking to my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren.
Exactly. And I don't
think... If you take 70% from each round, there'll be zero left.
Well, not if they do something with it. Don't you want your great-grandchildren to work hard just like you have done, rather than just, oh, my great-granddad, who I didn't even know, gave me 700 million quid. I'm going to live off that for the rest of my life. What kind of existence
course,
is that?
But if I make all this sacrifice, I don't age myself, and we all do this, you know, everyone's working hard. But if you're just giving it to the government, that's, again, disincentivizing me. Because
I think my kids...
I want to provide for generations. I want multi-generational wealth. And again, I don't have it now.
Well, take a holiday. Spend the money. Take a holiday. Spend the money. Buy a nice car. I don't know. Like, why do we prioritize? And, you know, if you do that, then that's creating other jobs. That's putting that money back into the economy, which is exactly my point, rather than storing it up in wealth.
You see, this is where it's difficult. It's difficult to change your opinion and others, but I will just say this, that it will definitely change the way that I would view living in the UK if they do all these things. Here's another thing. Microsoft did an IPO in 1986, right? That made 3 billionaires, potentially a lot more. 12,000 millionaires from employees were made from that company. When a company does well, the UK was full of, unfortunately, dinosaurs in the FTSE. If you look at the US, all these companies like Meta, Amazon, Tesla, look how much wealth that provides. How many employees are millionaires? We need companies like this to grow. We need to have tech companies in the UK. And we have the talent. The UK is full of amazing talent, but they all want to leave. When I go to startup conferences and I speak to other founders, they all just want to go to America.
Do you, Alex, accept that there does need to at least be some limits on wealth and on inherited wealth? Because if you don't, you end up in a situation than we have, and we're getting back towards that situation, by the way. Well, a situation you had in the 19th century and the Gilded Age, where you basically had, you know, if you look at when inequality was its peak in the 19th century, the top 10% owned 90% of the wealth. Now, would you accept that that was a problem? That was corrected by the big wealth taxes that came along in the 20th century as a result of the First and Second World War. Would you accept that what we saw in the 19th century, which was an age quite similar to our own increasingly, that was a problem?
But it's changed so much since then, right?
We're going back.
Well, I think actually the UK, we're losing a lot. I mean, if you look at the way the UK was, first of all, the UK is involved in every single war, right? We built industries. We were a country that led And we're not doing that now. We should be. We have the talent here. I mean, to think that, you know, standards of life and
in order to do that as well, it's not quite as simple as that, is it? Because in order to do that and to create that wealth, you have to have all of the components that allow you to create a business here. That means a highly educated workforce. That means a thriving HE sector. That means infrastructure that works. You don't make a business entirely on your own. And in order to have those things, you've got to have a sound tax base to pay for them.
I think we're taxing too much. I agree with you on income.
I agree with you on income. You're right. We are taxing too much. That's why we need to shift it.
The point I'm making is you can't just change the rule. Again, I'm not part of the elite. But if you start saying we're going to start doing heavy inheritance tax, that is going to disincentivize me to want to remain in the UK.
Okay.
And I'm born in the UK. I lived in the US. So I'm born to do a thing. Oh, this guy's just talking. He's American. He's, you know, expat.
But we can't win, can we? Because we also get people who say, therefore, that, you know, we're taxing income too highly, so they're going to go and live in Dubai, or they're going to go and live in Portugal, or wherever it is. So we've got to make a decision somewhere.
I think, like I said, you've got to put the horse in front of the cart. If you promote growth, wealth will be trickled down. Like I said, Microsoft, think about that.
That has been proved again and again not to be true, Alex. The myth of trickle-down economics, it just doesn't happen. We've had that since the 1980s, and in that time, inequality has only got worse and worse and worse. It's just not true.
So you're saying the US is not doing well compared to the UK?
It's doing well for some people, yeah, but it's doing not very well at all for a load and load of others. You've got sort of wealth concentrated in an increasingly tiny elite.
No, I mean, if you think the U.S. is not doing well, the U.K. was underpaid. It's really sad how much lower our growth is.
Yeah, I agree with that. I completely agree with you. But the idea as well, but the U.S. economy, as you know, wealth and income, highly, highly concentrated. Anyway, I'm grateful, Alex, putting the alternative point of view. And I get this is hard, this is difficult, but we've got to choose where we put the tax burden somewhere. And right now, we're putting it on the basis of working people who are getting up every day of the month and week and finding they have less and less to show for it. Particularly younger people. Meanwhile, you've got enormous, enormous wealth tied up in housing, tied up in assets, which is just sat there being untaxed. Largely as a result of decisions made decades ago. I know this is a difficult thing sometimes to sort of get across, but it doesn't have to be like this. There are other ways of doing our politics. It doesn't seem maybe totally natural right now, but that's because we've just done it in this way forever. Tim is in West Hampstead. Tim, good afternoon.
Hello. Gosh, I'm a first-time caller, and
good.
I'm really, really enjoying the conversation
that's going on.
I'm not as academic as some of your brilliant people who are on, but I am 82, and I talk from life experience. Just referring to your previous caller, I think he ought to watch that great American series called Breaking Bad.
Yes.
And also, friends of mine went to America to become lecturers, and they were terrified of becoming ill for the first 10 years because they couldn't afford their health business.
Well, that is true,
and that's an example of America. But what I was going on about, really, was the housing issue.
Go on.
And I've rented all my life,
oh, really?
And I have a son, and I've done every job known to mankind, from being a dustman to building and all sorts of things,
yeah,
apart from my actual profession. but what I was going to say is that Margaret Thatcher, with the right to buy originally, okay, a lot of people, allowed them to become richer and so on, selling their council flats and all. But what's happened is a total commodification of our whole economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is destroying a social atmosphere that I grew up in and has existed for a long time. Because it's actually a very subtle form of divide and rule, which is the absolute inherent nature of the politics in this country. And the quotes that everyone is using, which absolutely I couldn't understand, two phrases: social mobility and the housing ladder. Now, what would the subtext of those two phrases be? You can believe them, or you could read the subtext being, you should feel insecure about who you are and should be aspiring to be something greater.
Mm.
Now, in France, I heard a debate on there. I have French family. They said, in France, we work to have a life. In England, you live to work. And that's sort of what you were saying.
Yes.
I know I'm being a bit more sort of general and less precise with evidence, but I know that to be true. Our children now are starting life without any help, 50 grand in debt. Now, if you're from a rich family, you're going to make a lot of money out of 2.5% loan. You'll make money out of that.
Yes.
If you're a clever parent. If you have no capital and your parents are just working or maybe not working, but your son or daughter gets, you know, to start life, 50 grand in debt. My generation, we got grants. We didn't have to pay them back.
I know, it's absolute. And no one ever talks about that,
and
Tim.
So
no one ever talks about
talks
that.
About the, as you were saying, the top down and the knock-on effect which is hitting us now, why we're talking about it, mental health, all these issues that are coming up day to day are to do with, a lot to do with social insecurity.
Absolutely.
When I started off, we had a thing called social security. Now, if you try going down that path, you're virtually told you're a criminal. And it is total mental. And if you have social insecurity, it's going to affect your brain as well, particularly if you have children.
Tim,
sorry, that was a bit of a rant.
Well, you know what? That's what we like, Tim. And I can hardly criticise anyone for having a rant this morning, given the last 2 hours, can I? So Tim in West Hampstead, fantastic first-time caller there. Lots of people I can see really appreciating his comments. I quoted John Stuart Mill earlier saying this is an old idea. Let's go even further back. Plato, 360 BCE. The law should prevent the excessive accumulation of wealth in any one person's hands. The ideal is for no citizen to be rich or poor, for both conditions are harmful to a state. You don't get Plato with James O'Brien, dear. 12:47, LBC.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
No room at the inn. The numbers of asylum seekers lodging in hotels is up by 8% as challenges increase as well. If not hotels, then where?
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. Stop up on island fuel. Rest every 2 hours too. I inspect tire pressure and tread. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Do the 4 trip checks before every journey. National Highways.
There's plenty of summer still left to enjoy and lots of wines to enjoy it with. At Waitrose, we've got 25% off 6 or more bottles of wine or fizz over £6, like the citrusy Esprit de Chablis, perfect with chicken on the barbecue, or a Minuti M Special Edition Rosé, bursting with strawberries, grapefruit and delicate peach, and a fruity Sanleo Prosecco, best paired with a sunny spot in the garden. Fill the last days of summer and your wine rack with 25% off at Waitrose.
Selected stores and lines, subject to availability. Excludes Scotland, boxed wines and bottles priced £100 and over.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Fanning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable, and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling, and the whole world smiles with you.
FanningDental.co.uk.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12:49. James has texted to say, at least it's not a tinfoil hat, Lewis. You speak a painful truth to many who even the comfortable middle class would have to release tax on their income from their assets. We need more reformers, as opposed to the current crop of reformers, with a capital R, inspired by the politics of 1930s Europe. Clive says, Lewis, I entirely agree with your theories until we get to how the increased tax take is spent. If any our current officer class civil servant continue with vanity projects like HS2 and other reckless spending, then your theories would just not stand up. Well, it's certainly true, Clive, the government could waste the money, which would obviously be a disaster. Another text here. My parents are enjoying retirement after working terribly hard and being prudent. Now they've worked out a plan over the years and now the goalposts are moving. If one was to pass away, the other's pension is going to be horribly taxed. How do they now budget for that? The point of what I'm saying overall is if we move to a fairer taxation system, then by the time everyone gets to retirement, they'll have had more money to save for their retirement and actually provide for themselves as we get older, rather than, as I say, the genetic lottery of just hoping that, you know, your parents happen to own a home that they can pass on to you, which, as I say, doesn't seem to be a very satisfactory basis for any society. Anyway, we'll return to a couple of your calls before we get to 1 o'clock. First, though, interesting story. There's the government should abolish the Office for Budget Responsibility and replace it with a new forecasting body to unshackle the Chancellor from a constant pressure to raise taxes or cut spending. That is not from Liz Truss, as you might expect, but rather a left-wing think tank, the New Economics Foundation, urging Rachel Reeves to overhaul the fiscal framework, abolishing the independent watchdog that was set up by George Osborne in 2010. More and more people, institutions that you might not expect calling for this, basically saying what it's doing is creating a sort of system where the Chancellor is constantly chasing her own or his own, doesn't matter whether it's Labour or Conservative or wherever it is, tail to justify basically imaginary fiscal forecasts that will probably never come to be. Dom Caddick is economist for the New Economics Foundation, authored this report. Dom, it's interesting, isn't it? There are more and more voices coming out saying that the current framework is not working. What has led you to this conclusion?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I was looking back today, I tweeted about our report launch and someone was like, well, you've changed your tune 2 years ago. You were saying that Liz Truss and the OBR, Liz Truss avoiding the OBR is like the root of all evil. And it's funny to me because I actually wrote a blog 2 years ago saying that the Office for Budget Responsibility needed reform and that when Labour first announced their fiscal lock to sort of say that they should never be able to avoid the Office for Budget Responsibility, that this would be a huge mistake. And since then, I've been sort of thinking about, well, how actually can we design an institution that protects us against these sort of like Liz Truss mini budget fallouts, whilst also allowing the Chancellor to, you know, forge a different path. I think the main thesis of the paper is that, you know, what the OBR has done, it was set up by George Osborne to say, we're going to eliminate the deficit, we're going to reduce the debt. But really, it just provided cover for his austerity measures that really like decimated public spending and, you know, cause misery for for hundreds of thousands of people. And I think when we had Labour going into the election saying they weren't going to return to austerity, their promise to also have a fiscal lock, it was a contradiction. And what our report is saying is how you can reform the OBR, replace it with a new institution that we call the Office of Fiscal Transparency, to allow the Chancellor to disagree, allow them to forge a different path, and allow them to actually finally end austerity.
Wouldn't it a danger? But I mean, I think we can, I certainly agree with you that there have been all sorts of unintended consequences, or perhaps intended from Osborne, who knows, but damaging consequences of the way this is now being done, including a sort of chasing 5-year fiscal horizons, which are, you know, it's not the OBR's fault, they're just very hard to predict, are almost usually always illusory. Yeah. That said, obviously, we've got a fiscal problem at the moment. We know that our gilt, the UK government borrowing costs are getting higher. They nearly reached a 27-year high the other day. When Liz Truss decided to ignore the normal way of doing things, of course, that was part of the reason that the markets reacted so badly. If the Chancellor were to dismantle the architecture at this time, is there not a risk that she would spook the markets?
Yeah. Well, I think the thing to recognise here is that austerity didn't work, right? We had austerity, we cut budgets, we still had borrowing and debt increasing. So it didn't work, and why should we go back to the same thing? And I think, you know, what the economic consensus is, at least in the literature I read, is the best way to get yourself out of a problem of debt or a deficit is to grow the economy, right? It's to invest in things that lead to economic growth. And at the moment, the OBR does have some capacity to acknowledge that some policies lead to growth, but it's really restricted to this supply side framework. So it only really ever considers tax cuts, or it only just recently considered the fact that public investment could have a good effect on growth. And what this means is that things like, poverty reduction or reforming the NHS in ways that would, you know, prevent people from becoming ill, those never get seen as growth enhancing policies because they're sort of put into this demand side box of the OBR. And when it's in the demand side box, it gets told by the OBR that it's not going to have any impact on long term growth. And that's really important because, as you sort of like introduced at the start, we're in a position right now where like decimal point changes in the forecast, whether of growth or interest rates, can really like change how much the Chancellor needs to cut spending or raise taxes in the tens of billions. And that's you know, it's an insane situation to be in, but it's also an insane situation to be in when, as you acknowledged as well, like forecasts are sort of always wrong. And you know, why are we in this position where the OBR is defining the forecast rather than scrutinizing it, right? We don't want the government to be able to avoid scrutiny. That's what led to the Liz Truss crisis. But we want the government to be able to disagree with scrutiny if it's justified. And I think the fact that austerity doesn't work, the fact that you have people like even the International Monetary Fund saying that growth policies are good, like, there's more to do here.
All right. Dom Caddick there, economist for the New Economics Foundation, who authored this report. A bit of breaking news as well. RMT tube strikes today, announcing a rolling strike action. Oh, terrific. Across the network, beginning on Friday, the 5th of September, for 7 days, with different grades taking industrial action at different times. The strikes come after management refused to engage seriously with union demands on pay, they say. Fatigue management, shift patterns and a reduction in the working week, as well as failing to honour previous agreements made with staff. That's the RMT announcing that just now. So tube strikes, unless they're avoided, to come from Friday the 5th of September. Great to see a text message here from Martin. Great to hear Plato on LBC. Good news. Yeah, I have a good news, Martin. I think I hear that he's going to be doing a new show on Fridays from 7 to 8. Ping Plato. Adam is in Eastbourne. Adam.
Hi. Yes, I've enjoyed the conversation about inheritance tax. And
good.
The thing that sort of got to me, you've got the lady in Brighton who was very emotive about it.
Yes.
And that sort of prompted me to call, really, because with this whole tax, you know, I'm very much in favour of it because it is a way of equalising, you know, the way that we've got generational wealth, but people don't buy into it. So let's try and flip it on its head. Why don't we have an individual lifetime inheritance tax threshold, allowance.
Mm.
So maybe you can inherit £100,000, £200,000 tax-free as an individual.
Mm.
I think that would be a far better way to look at it, because then you're looking at it in terms of the actual person that's got the wealth, the windfall, rather than it being a tax on the person that's passed.
Yes, I think that the, yes, I can see what you're saying. So the, we need to reframe basically how we think about the tax itself.
Yes, that's exactly it. I think if we were to turn it round so that we very much look at it as a windfall for a person that's inheriting a sum of money, and then you gave people a tax-free allowance that, you know, perhaps is across their entire lifetime, that might also encourage people that, you know, are writing their wills to think about who they want to leave it to as well. So you may choose to leave more money to your grandchildren so that, you know, that there's less tax to pay.
All right, Adam, grateful to you. Let's give the last word to Sheila. Not Sheila Fogarty, who's coming up, but Sheila, who's in Church Langley in Essex. Sheila.
All right. Hello, Lewis. Lewis, I'll try and be as quick as I possibly can.
Yes, you'll have to be.
When COVID was on, poor Hubby had a really bad stroke, a devastating stroke that left him without his speech and couldn't lift his head up. And I lost my son at the same time.
Oh, gosh,
but what I'm getting at is, now, he's still in the care home, and that's £1,400 a week, so after 4 years, my savings, our savings now have gone.
Oh,
and I dread the fact that what's going to happen to the house, you know.
Yes.
And you don't sleep the night. But the thing is, now, if inheritance tax hits us as well, you know, honestly, it's going to be so, so terrible. And possibly for many others as well, you know. And then you sort of think, why are the royal family not paying any taxes? The Duke of Westminster, many, many more.
Okay.
So why are they hitting the likes of us that have worked? My husband worked since he was 14,
yes.
Me in the NHS. And so, you know, you save, you go without stuff to just save for the future, for the grandchild, you know. And you know, here we are in this most awful situation. And, you know, nothing is being done about the care homes to, you know, enlighten that burden a bit for people. And, you know, as soon as the awful things happen, the Court of Protection takes over. They get hold of all your savings and you have no say in anything.
Sheila, I'm really grateful to you. Thank you for rounding that off. And I'm really sorry to hear about that experience. I suppose what I would say is that if we change the tax system more effectively, then hopefully we might be able to finally sort out social care so your family would not be in that position. But that is a whole conversation for a whole another day. After calling for a 100% inheritance tax, I'm 100% done. So I'll be back tomorrow from 10. If you missed any of today's show, you can, of course, catch up on both Global Player and the brand new LBC app. You can do all the bells and whistles there. You can pause, rewind live radio, listen to a range of podcasts, including, of course, The News Agents, which I'm off to go and record solo now because John Sopel is completely hapless. Download the all-new official LBC app. You can't rely on him, for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Ben Kentish. But now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much indeed, Lewis. We'll have more on that RMT strike that Lewis was just telling you about a few moments ago. Israeli forces are in Gaza City, something you spoke about at the very beginning of your show, Lewis. We'll have a report and a report on a teenager who's been jailed for his plan to destroy a mosque in Scotland. He got very close to being able to do so. I want to talk about AI at three. AI-driven companions, always available, and they never judge, but could they distort our view on human friendship and indeed our view on our own humanity? GCSE results are out. I want to talk about trades versus uni. But we begin with the numbers of asylum seekers lodging in hotels. It's up by 8% as challenges look set to increase too to the practice of placing them in hotels. But if not hotels, where? Where?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, figures reveal there are more than 32,000 asylum seekers being housed in hotels at the end of Labour's first year in office. It marks a rise of 8% on the previous year, but is a slight fall in the overall total since March. It says the Conservatives are contacting councils they control to urge them to challenge the use of hotels after an injunction in Epping. Shadow Home Secretary Chris Phillips says they're right to raise the issue.
There are concerns which Epping Council articulated in their legal action that putting hundreds of young men into the middle of a small community can have quite significant impacts. But you know, to get to the heart of this, to really stop this problem happening, you've got to stop the crossings. And that is why Labour have made such a big mistake by allowing these crossings to reach record ever levels this year.
Labour has dismissed Kemi Badenoch's letter to councils as desperate and hypocritical nonsense. The wife of a Tory councillor jailed for stirring up racial hatred has been released after serving around a third of her sentence. Lucy Connolly was jailed for 31 months last October over a post in which she called for people to set fire to hotels housing migrants after the Southport stabbings. An American who was convicted over the failed assassination of a man in Birmingham has been jailed for 30 years. 45-year-old Amy Betrow flew to the UK planning to shoot a man for a rival family from Derby. LBC's Midlands reporter Luke Shanahan was at Birmingham Crown Court.
At around 8 p.m. on the 7th of September 2019, Amy Betrow walked up as a man arrived home and got out of his car. She pointed a gun at him and pulled the trigger. The gun jammed and the target, Sikander Ali, scrambled back into his car and drove away. Betrow came back a few hours later, having presumably fixed her gun, because this time she fired three shots through the windows of Sikander's home before again scuttling away.
In the last few minutes, the RMT union has announced rolling strikes on the London Underground next month. Members will walk out for 7 days in a dispute over pay, conditions and what they describe as broken agreements. We've asked TfL for comment. And more than one entry in every five got the top grades in this year's GCSEs. There was a very slight rise of 0.1 percentage point when compared to last year. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 20 points at 92.68. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.15. LBC weather staying largely cloudy for northern and central England this afternoon. Sunny spells developing elsewhere. The odd spot of drizzle in eastern coastal areas. A high of 21 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello. Hello there. Good afternoon to you. If you're just joining us here at LBC, very good to be with you. We will have an update or a little bit more information on that RMT strike that's just been announced. That's what everybody needs, isn't it? Like a hole in the head, but it's coming. The latest Home Office figures, though, on asylum seekers in UK hotels. There are other immigration stats out today as well we can reflect on, but it's those hotel numbers that really catch the eye, not least because of that decision on the Bell Hotel in Epping, a temporary decision based on planning regulations rather than anything else. But still, it is being certainly used by some politicians, the leader of the Conservative Party included, as a political victory for the residents in Epping. Doesn't necessarily mean that the exact same circumstances can be overlaid onto any council who decides to challenge the use of a hotel in their area. But we shall see. And it's almost certain that other challenges will come. But let me tell you these statistics that have come out today. 32,059 asylum seekers in UK hotels at the end of June. That's up 8% on the same point a year ago. And although it's higher than a year ago, the total is slightly down on the previous quarter. So ups and downs, as well as down on the peak back in September 2023, when the Conservatives were still in power, of 56,000 people in hotels. We had one minister, former Conservative minister, I should say, saying that they got that policy wrong. The data also shows there was a record number of asylum claims in the UK in the past year. And that row over hotels is growing, isn't it? This week, the High Court said that hotel in Epping, the Bell, should stop housing asylum seekers after a challenge from the local council. It looks pretty certain that other councils, other areas will challenge the use of hotels. But if not hotels, then where? Where do we house people? And there's another statistic to look at, which is what the regional breakdown is as to where people end up being sent, and exactly which cities, which towns are most affected. The local councils that are hosting the most dispersal asylum accommodation, as it's called, so, you know, dispersal from the coast, not concentrating at all in Kent and Dover or the southeast. Glasgow has the highest number, then Belfast, then Liverpool, then Coventry, then Birmingham. If you live in any of these places, is it something you get a sense of very visibly where you live? Birmingham is in at number 5 in this top 10. Sandwell at number 6. Nottingham after that, then Cardiff, then Wigan, then Leicester. That's Home Office data this morning. So the number of asylum seekers in hotels has risen by 2,500 since Labour took office, the equivalent of 50 extra a week. Labour, just as a reminder, has pledged to end the use of asylum hotels by 2029, and it has already reduced the use of them. But you can almost feel it in real time, can't you? Becoming more and more of a political question as much as a practical question, which it, of course, is as well. Dr. Madeline Sumption joins me, Director of the Migration Observatory at the University of Oxford. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
If not hotels, where are we even remotely ready for an alternative?
Well, if it does turn out that the Home Office has to move people out of hotels much quicker than anticipated, it's going to face quite a challenge, I think. The two main options are what you referred to, this dispersal accommodation, which is basically sort of houses or flats usually set up as in multiple occupancies, so several different people living in the same place. And that's what we've traditionally used in the UK for going back years. The challenge for the government is just sourcing that accommodation, because their housing is very expensive in the UK. A lot of people struggling to get on the housing ladder, so they're sort of competing in the same pool as many other people. So it's difficult to secure that accommodation. The numbers have gone up slowly over time. The other main options is what's is something